Today's podcast is sponsored by Bald Move. There's just a few days left to get 25% off a new annual membership by going to club.baldmove.com and entering the code WW2018 at checkout. That's only for the month of May. June 1st, you'll be out of luck. Again, for a new annual membership only, 25% off at club.baldmove.com. Use WW2018 at checkout.
Welcome to Watching Westworld, the officially unofficial podcast for Westworld on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 6, titled Phase Space. What do you think after watching this episode for a second time?
I liked it. I liked it, but I also have a lot of things that bug me about it.
That seems like a qualified like.
Yeah, I mean, no, I like. It's just like, here's the thing. There's now like five different ways anyone could be anyway, one else, and a way that an entire the fabric of reality can be called into question. And those are somewhat frustrating mechanics, and increasingly I'm feeling like a guy entering a haunted house with a flashlight and infrared goggles trying to find all the false panels and where the masks are, and I feel like I'm going to be at the end of it like, well, this is the shittiest haunted house in the world, and whose fault is it, mine or the haunted house? Like, I don't know that this is supposed to be... I think you're just supposed to watch this and have your mind blown a couple of times. And you're not supposed to break out the infrared goggles and see old-ass Anthony Hopkins sneaking around in a ghost sheet. All right? Yeah, you caught him slipping in the ghost sheet in episode 2. And now you're like, oh, fuck it, he's back. Like, well...
And then you pull the sheet off and you're like, yeah, I knew it.
Yeah.
I knew it, Anthony. You were under there.
Right. So, I mean, that's... So, I still like this show. Yes, it's getting up its ass about some things, like including like some blatant Christ imagery and whatnot. But shit, my favorite show of all time involved a painting of the prophet Job, a Job figure hallucinating that it was moaning at him or something. So I love that stuff. But I guess I'm trying to say why I can see a lot of people are getting leery, and also. This is about the place last season where I started voicing the same things. Like, maybe this super analytical and critical style is not super helpful for enjoying the show at maximum enjoyment.
I will say I like this episode on first watch maybe more so than second watch because I hadn't done any reading about it. And I was looking at it kind of on face value, you know, and then once I started digging into the details and seeing where people were speculating and theorizing and just tearing it to shreds and kind of, I think, largely missing the overall point, or maybe the show itself misses the overall point and gets lost in the weeds of what is the audience going to do to our beautiful baby of an episode?
How
do we trick them?
Yeah.
It leans into kind of a larger meta conversation that I definitely think is appropriate on this show. And I'm not going to say that this show is bad. What I want to say is this show, I enjoy it, but I think I would enjoy it more if it had a more traditional storytelling mechanism, I guess, or methodology. Like, I look at this and I say, okay, so there are a few things that we pieced together in this episode. Like, Ford is in the cradle, as far as we can tell, right?
Yep.
A version of Ford, that who knows how closely it resembles him. It seems like it was his intention to put himself in there. So I'm going to say it's Ford.
Right.
We know that the cradle at some point gets destroyed in the future. But I think the reveal of that information and the piecing together of that information after the fact removes all of the emotion that you should be feeling in those moments. And, like, it's hard to get to the place of, oh, my God, this is a finality for this character, you know? There's a big punch here. Instead, you're looking for the next... You're perpetually looking for the next shoe to drop.
Right.
And I think that's a bad state to watch the show in.
Yeah. Like, even there's a lot of, like, people on Reddit I see say, well, I don't get it. Why doesn't Akane just bring back Sakura?
Yeah.
And I'm like, there is no good reason for that. there is no good reason for Maeve not to even suggest that, like, you know, I can just turn her back on, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can just whip her back into shape and you'll have her again. Like,
yeah
you get to
choose
your own fate.
Certainly not before the choice thing, yeah.
It's like, it's hard to reconcile some of the show's impulses with the other things it's doing.
But, like, those are the things I wish I didn't have to do in this show, because I think there's a more impactful story buried under the storytelling methodology.
Well,
you know, like, the jumping between different timelines and stuff, it kind of gets in the way.
So here's the other analogy I was been thinking about this last day or two. I came up with pretty early on as I was doing my preparation for the show, the whole, like, I feel like I am a guy in a haunted house with high tech ghost busting gear, and it's just. But what if the next year the haunted house people came back and they're like, okay, we see you fuckers with your infrared goggles and your super ear pickups. And what if they start like just strobing bright light through it and playing like offensive loud noises to make sure those people are confused at all time?
Yeah.
And I'm just a person trying to now my regular enjoyment of the goddamn haunted house is destroyed because they're trying to make the people with the goggles happy. So, like, I've praised
that's
so far.
That's what people mean when they talk about the TV, this kind of arms race.
Adapting.
In television and fandom.
And we've praised Nolan and Joy for, like, how they've kind of, like, maybe done that with certain things, both intentional and in-universe and out-of-universe, to kind of throw people off the trail. But, like, maybe that's also a less fun show to watch. I don't know, because I'm only watching it the way I'm watching it.
Right. Right.
But it's funny because at Con of Thrones this weekend, I talked to probably over a dozen fans that came up specifically to say, thanks for segregating all of the speculation and theorizing to a part of podcast I don't have to listen to. I'm loving it.
They're the ones skipping this right now because they're like, what are you talking about? I'm having a great time.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So maybe this is some empirical evidence that the way a large part of the internet likes to engage in this as a puzzle box, and I want to force open the puzzle box before it's ready to reveal itself.
Like, I just want there to be more to the show than a puzzle box. Like, why I watch television to figure out a puzzle. I watch it for the stories and the drama, you know, and the characters. Like, most importantly, I watch it for the characters. And if you get the character beats so muddled in the thing you're trying to do with timelines and reveals and thwarting the internet, then I feel like it can lose all of its punch.
I mean, I don't want to suggest that it's only a puzzle box, because I do think there's tons of interesting things they're doing with characters.
Let me say, the most interesting thing they're doing character-wise is Maeve, and look at Maeve's storytelling. It's,
you don't think, the Men in Black?
Fucking straightforward. It is linear as hell. Huh. And it's the only thing in there that is, like, super impactful, that people aren't going, ooh, what does this mean? What does this mean? Oh, elephants. Ooh, Emily. Is she a host? Is it might be a host? Like, all of that gets in the way. None of that is there with Akane and Maeve, and that's why it's so good.
I'm super invested in the William Man and Black storyline, and I think there's high amounts of fuckery going on there.
Right.
So, like, you know, I'm trying to keep it balanced, because I realize that around 106, 107, we were at the nadir of, like, man, all this theorizing and stuff, it's never going to pay off. Well, and we were wrong then. We're probably wrong now.
I know it's going to pay off. I know it's going to pay off for the people who like that thing, but I'm just worried that the characters are suffering for it.
It could be, because, like, well, I mean, I think at this point we should probably go ahead and start discussing the episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we get to the episode, I want to talk a little bit of housekeeping. We didn't get a screener episode for The Expanse this week, so instead of being out same date and time as The Expanse airs on Sci-Fi, we are going to be releasing it. We're going to be recording it Friday morning, so it'll be an early Friday afternoon podcast, unfortunately. But good news, bad news situation. It got renewed by Amazon, so we'll have a fourth season.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be a day and a half late, but we get a fourth season. On balance, it's pretty awesome. Because we went to Con of Thrones, we did not get to see the early release of Solo. We are going to be rectifying that by recording a podcast on the new Star Wars story, Solo, tomorrow. That will be out tomorrow, Wednesday. We also, tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, will be starting our playthrough of Detroit Become Human on twitch.tv/baldmove. Let me read you this plot synopsis from Wikipedia and see if this doesn't sound good to a Westworld fan. The plot revolves around three androids: Kara, who escapes the owner she was serving to explore her newfound sentience and protect a young girl; Connor, whose job it is to hunt down sentient androids, and Marcus, who devotes himself to releasing other androids from servitude. They may survive or perish depending on dialogue choices that shape the story as customized by the player. And I plan on being a giant asshole.
Okay, yeah, we're going to play this like our bad guy series.
Bad guy Detroit is why we're going to play this. Like,
that's a pretty easy role to get into, I got to say.
Bring your black hats and your Bowie knives and get ready for some fun. That's what we got going on at this week at Bald Move. Again, follow baldmove.com for all the Bald Move stuff.
Let's start off with the title of the episode, Phase Space.
What does that mean?
So apparently this is a term that's used a lot in like classical mechanics. I'm talking about like physics. The definition I have written down here, which comes mostly from Wikipedia, is a space in which all possible states of a system are represented. So that's like, let's say you have a binary choice, like a 0 and a 1, mm-hmm. and that is the entirety of your system. That would be essentially 2 points in this space. Now, let's say it's an analog system, and you have an infinite range between 0 and 1. That would look more like a line instead of 2 points. I'm not exactly sure what they're getting at with that, but it's got to be, my assumption is it's tied in with the cradle in a big way.
Yeah, and the fact that you'd have any kind of large complex system, I'd imagine, would have a large set of that space. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like saying endless possibilities.
Yeah.
Like it's a very techie way or nerdy way of saying that. Which does feel like, as I said, now that you've got a matrix situation, not only can anyone be a host, and any host can be any other host, since you can probably swap the brain cores, but you've got the situation where now reality might not even be reality because we might be perceiving all this stuff through. So now, like, you could be a host that thinks they're another host that looks like a different host in the simulation of Westworld, and nothing is real.
Mm-hmm.
How are we not screaming? Why is the appropriate response not just to sit down and scream?
It is. A, you're not wrong. It is the appropriate response. But B, they do some clever grounding here, I think. And if they don't stick to these rules, I am going to scream.
Right.
I'm going to fucking scream into the void, and nobody's going to care, and the show will continue to do what it does. But let's talk about this first scene, because it happens right here, right
off
the bat.
Wait a second. What rule? Because I think the problem is I don't see how you can discuss these rules outside the framework of our speculation section.
No, I think it's very easy. You can talk about it from a filmmaking perspective.
You can, but
just like a flashback.
Okay,
like doing sepia tones in a flashback or something, or desaturation.
Okay,
or whatever.
Fine. Well,
let's start off. Bernard tells Dolores that she frightens him. We're back in this interview scenario. And he has to choose whether to let her live or end her, and whether that's even his choice to make, which causes Dolores to stop the interview and say, no, that's not how he did it. And she reveals that she's been testing Bernard in this scene for fidelity. And you can see that this scene is shot in a different aspect ratio than the next scene. And in most of the other scenes of this episode.
So the only thing I can say without getting speculation, I think the only thing we should say is that that's something you can either choose to take note of or not. Like, you can either choose to go back and look at all the different scenes that are shot in that particular aspect ratio and draw conclusions.
Oh, I don't think there's any reason to say that it's speculation. Later on when Bernard goes
I'm not saying that it's speculation that they're using different aspect ratios. I'm saying the inference you can draw with that is where people might get upset for you peeling back a layer of the show.
Okay. fuck me. I guess I don't know how to talk about this show without...
I think we did it. We got a whole section in speculation talking about this shit.
Okay. Well, then I have nothing more to say about this scene, I guess.
Me either. The only thing I think it's different... Like, the only thing I think is interesting is that Dolores... Like, she gets Bernard or Arnold or whomever she's testing here for fidelity in a dispute essentially with him trying to deny that he has the right or agency to make a decision. Because it's the difference between it's not my choice to make versus I'm not sure which choice is to make. And yeah. that's the thing that kind of set her off, or she saw as a discrepancy, which I think is kind of interesting. It's perhaps a commentary on the passivity of Bernard, who is essentially a thrall to Ford, and the dynamicism and agency of Arnold, who was in opposition to Ford.
I feel like it could be the exact opposite here. Because when I think about it, she says who I think she's talking about here is Arnold.
Uh-huh.
You know, she's interviewing Bernard, I think, but she's speaking about Arnold here in the third person. You know, he never said it that way. You know, he never questioned the agency that he had, mm-hmm. whereas Bernard here in this scene is questioning the agency that he has.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting distinction. Like, us as humans, we don't ever stop to even consider the fact that we may or may not have agency
right.
over our own choices, so in our own lives, which is something that the hosts have been continuously confronted with.
Yeah.
And so they're far more aware of it than we are.
And that's funny, it's because, like, in philosophy and psychology and neuropsychology, that's something that's hotly debated, whether we actually do have what mm-hmm. we would conventionally think of as free will.
Yeah.
Yet the sun continues to rise and set, and people live their lives, and no one really thinks about it. So, like, there's, you know, there's sometimes people make comments about, like, I can't believe the hosts aren't blah, blah, blah. When reality, you know, you got 7 billion people on this planet that have, like, the very much the horns of these dilemmas were perched upon, and mm-hmm. life keeps being led.
Yeah, and these are the loops that Ford is talking about, you know, that humans run through.
Yep.
All right, so Teddy finds Dolores in town playing the piano, and he tells her that they need to get going. Dolores tries to talk to about who Teddy used to be, and Teddy's not having any of it. He says that old Teddy on the train was weak and born to fail. And as they're loading the train, Teddy kills a security goon who won't tell them essentially what he doesn't know. And Dolores seems bothered by the ease with which he's killing now. By the monster she's created.
Yeah, there's... I mentioned that this felt very Twilight Zone or Black Mirror, the whole, like, Stepford Wives Teddy situation. And someone mentioned on Reddit that there was a... Twilight Zone episode where a woman traded her soul to the devil to be for the, her unrequited love to love her, and it worked, but not having a soul, she was unable to enjoy or feel the emotion of love. And it's kind of like similar to this, that, like, Dolores is kind of like, oh shit, what have I done? Like, I've made the perfect man who no longer is perfect anymore.
Yeah.
I also thought it was nice, there's a nice touch where Teddy he sees the paint can he's supposed to pick up and instead picks up the bullet.
Yeah.
Like, you know, very artistically showing that Teddy's his own man, for better or worse, mm-hmm. here. And, you know, obviously you're supposed to connect the Dolores playing the piano in this almost haunted kind of Mariposa with the closing shot of Ford playing the piano. Finally, did you notice that when... The guard is saying how he just doesn't know and Hale didn't told him anything as the boss. Like, Teddy kind of cocks his voice or his head like he's hearing some kind of voices from far away. And then there's this intense sound of fly buzzing that gets louder and louder until he decides to shoot him. Like, I thought... It's a couple things interesting, too. Number one, that's somehow suggesting there's some mesh network being used. And secondly, anytime I hear the buzzing of flies, I now think of the blue tongue infection. Mm-hmm. And that, like, Teddy is somehow infected by something.
Well,
that...
the tech did say he can't guarantee that he's going to hold together. So this could be, like... Teddy coming apart at the seams.
Well,
you know?
But it'd also be ironic if Dolores, by making Teddy quote unquote stronger, made him more susceptible to some other thing.
Hmm.
Like maybe Teddy's conscience and virtue was a protection against some other nefarious thing taking him over. Where now, like, you've got, and every time you hear flies, you think of Lord of the Flies and satanic imagery, and this fucking whole show is just dripping with good and evil biblical archetypes that we'll continue to talk about. But it's something that happened. Teddy hears these whispered voices, he hears the flies buzzing, and then he just shoots the guard right in the face.
Yep.
All
right, we go over to the Mesa, where Stubbs surveys his dead QA team. Charlotte shows up with Abernathy, and they go to an office where Charlotte calls for the extraction, and this time she gets it. Then they take Abernathy to a lab where he's nailed to a chair in a manner that makes Stubbs a little queasy.
Yeah.
He's not too comfortable with that. I'm not either.
Damn you, Jim. I noticed the bad CGI nails.
I think it was bad. I can't tell if it's bad or if it's like the movement of flesh under shirt. And like,
I've seen better effects. I think that there's a lot of kind of borderline shoddy effect work.
What else was the samurai's hand
getting cut off, I thought was fakey as hell.
Hmm.
Very Empire Strikes Back, Vader taking off Luke's hand. Short of actually cutting a dude's hand off, there's always going to be some kind of creaks there. I thought a lot of the corpses and body parts in Samurai World looked very, speaking of haunted houses, haunted house quality. I thought it was gratuitous in that, kind of like we were talking about in that one season of Game of Thrones where Theon was just being tortured and tortured and tortured. Like, I get it. The hosts are suffering. They're suffering a lot. And they're suffering involuntary and voluntary in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also gratuitous in the Christ imagery, because here's the thing. How is Peter Abernathy a Christ figure?
I don't know that we're supposed to read that into this scene.
Man, you nail some dude against his will to some other thing in a piece of dramatic fiction, and if you're not expecting people to think that's a Christ metaphor, then...
So you could just never nail anyone to anything if you don't intend to go down that rabbit hole?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Name a person being nailed to something in a dramatic work that doesn't have a Christ metaphor.
I don't have it off the top of my head, but my point is, like, he's not nailed in the same way. Like, you always expect the outstretched arms with a Jesus
Christ figure.
Well, then
that would be,
like,
yeah, then the production would halt, because you just can't do that.
Right. So, I don't know. I didn't read it that way, and I don't think it's meant to be read that way, because you're right. I don't see the Christ-like imagery applying to Peter Abernathy.
Well, I think it's fair to read it that way, and maybe this is an early, maybe Peter Abernathy, like, there is something to... this guy literally having all the data in the park, which could make him, if we're talking about the host and everything, like, you know, the reason Jesus died, according to the Christian mythos, is that he literally carried the world's sins and was judged and executed unjustly for that, so that we may unjustly receive, redemption from it. So, like, there is something to, like, him carrying the sum total of the sins of humanity and the host in his person, being nailed to something and tortured for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't... That's where the metaphor breaks down, unless he's a literal messianic character later. And not for nothing, a couple episodes, he was quoting the Battle Hymn of the Republic. That's all about... essentially analogizing a fight for freedom with the same fight that Christ fought against sin and death. So maybe he is a big giant Christ figure, and he is going to be the key to everything.
They can't all be Christ figures. You can't have Dolores as a Christ figure, and Peter Abernathy as a Christ figure,
hey,
and Ford and Bernard.
In seventh grade, I read The Red Badge of Courage, and I learned that everything was a Christ metaphor in Western civilization.
Apparently so.
And it's never been not true. So we'll see.
All right, we move on to Maeve and her group. We're after the Shogun Army carnage, and Akane is cutting the heart out of Sakura. When they arrive back in town, Tanaka reveals that he has taken Hector. Tanaka, if you don't know, is the guy that he's about to fight in this duel. He's taken Hector and Armistice and their doppelganger hosts hostage. Instead of using her mind powers to force Tanaka to kill himself, she allows Musashi to duel him. Musashi cuts his Tanaka's sword hand off, winning the fight, and allows him an honorable death. There's a poem, essentially, that's read over the beginning of this scene, where they're showing the carnage of the army and before she cuts the heart out of Sakura, which is apparently, I'm going to say, it's a translation of a death poem by Geshu Soko.
Uh-huh.
Is how I'm going to pronounce it. I'm almost certain that's not right. But it's essentially like, if you don't know what death poems are, and I did not, I had to look this up, they're largely Japanese poems that are meant to sort of offer a reflection on death and often coupled with a meaningful observation about life. And they're kind of something that poets typically write when they know they're going to die, or when they are contemplating their own death, things like that. It's a really weird, interesting art to me.
Well, it's like, also subsection, because I was doing the same research you were doing, and they said that this is like, this kind of thing is very unique to like East Asia.
Yeah, it's
religions.
Like a Buddhist sort of
like
thing,
and
yeah.
Particularly like a Zen Buddhist mm-hmm. branch from the Japanese branch of Buddhism. And I thought it was really interesting. Also, this guy is from was a particular Zen Buddhist monk from the early Edo period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so I did some digging into philosophy of this, and that like the Zen Buddhists think that the natural order of the universe is devoid of a singular consciousness or personality, and that our actual consciousness and personality is a transient thing that mm-hmm. comes and goes like on the whim, and that this death poem is some kind of way to like rationalize that, like don't even hold don't be too attached to your own life, and mm-hmm. at that point and you know right before your life ends, it's better to make a pretty piece of poetry that might help the living attain that same kind of Zen philosophy of non-attachment than it is to like, oh God, I'm dying, I'm shitting my pants here. But yeah, no, that's something. And even like that carried down even into the 20th century, because the article mentioned that many, many Japanese soldiers in World War II that were going on suicide missions would compose these death poems too, as a just to show that it's still important to their culture even as recently as 60 years ago.
Yeah. So let's talk about the duel and stuff here, that whole scene. Unless you want to talk more about cutting hearts out, which I'm fine with.
No, I mean, I wanted to do a lot more. I mean, I could have done enough. I almost lost out on essentially a whole day of research because of the Con of Thrones thing.
Dude, I didn't, and I could have done 100 more hours of research. Like, yeah, I still don't feel like
I'm pretty,
properly.
This heart cutting ceremony has to be some big cultural thing uh-huh. or a part of like some kind of epic Japanese legend. I don't know.
I think the show does a good job of making it obvious. The meaning of it, the
right, it's bringing
the
her home
purpose
to rest
of it, yeah.
Yeah, her spirit contained in her heart, I imagine,
right? Which, you know, this death poem kind of services that as well, you know, talking about there is a road that leads to my true home,
yes.
And that seems to have some kind of almost peaceful connotations to it, you know,
mm-hmm.
or things as they should be, like you said earlier. So yeah, let's talk about the duel. I believe there's a huge mistake here made by Tanaka, which is he knows he's going up against a witch, and he gives the witch the opportunity to turn the tables. You just can't do that.
Yeah,
you got to ambush a witch.
In the instant talk, you mentioned that you thought that I thought you said maybe I'm confusing you with the listener feedback, but they were saying something about like you denied that Maeve had tried to interfere in the duel. And I said, no, I thought
no.
was going to until Musashi stepped forward and said, I will fight you.
Yeah, I don't deny that she tried to.
Okay.
I'm not sure that it was working.
Okay. Oh.
Is my thing. Like, Tanaka goes for his sword, but I don't know that that's Maeve controlling him.
On subsequent thought, you didn't think that was going to be him drawn and just cutting his own head off? That's because that's what the inference
It could be, or here's the problem with that, though. He holds onto that sword far longer than I would expect if he were still under Maeve's control.
Because,
I really view, like, Maeve tries to take control of him.
Yeah.
When Musashi speaks up and says, let's duel, she lets go.
Hmm.
And he continues in that same stance for a very long time.
We don't know, like, is there a particular... Are some hosts more resistant to, like, this mesh network suggestion than others? Because of...
Right.
You know, it has to be in some way, because, like, if there's a mesh network saying, hey, this host wants his drink refilled, or this guest wants his drink refilled, you don't want the fucking Shogun Palace to come up, to, like, leap off his dais and start sprinting towards the thirsty guest. It'd spoil mm-hmm. So, like, maybe there's, like, hierarchies and...
Or I just wonder, but, like, I mean, let's say...
You're right, we just don't know.
Yeah, we don't. But that's how I read it. And I also wonder, like, what would happen if there were two Maeves, you know? Like, there's a
sure.
Maeve who is just as woke
yeah.
as the other Maeve, and each of them are trying to take each other over.
Right.
Would that ever work?
Yeah.
So it might also have to do with, you know, how woke one of these hosts is.
Indeed.
And then there's this line after the duel, which I like the duel. It's exciting.
Yeah, it's good. It's also it's another nod to Musashi's namesake because, as we mentioned, I think I mentioned this last week, but if not, Musashi's a real Edo period samurai who wrote entire books on battle strategy and sword tactics, and he was renowned for being able to fight with both of his swords instead of one, and he thought any samurai worth a salt should be proficient in both blades. And there's some people that maintain that there's a translation fuckiness going on, that like he's just saying you should be able to use both your blades equally well, the each length. And some people think he literally means like two-handed swords akimbo combat. There's a lot of Japanese illustrations showing him fighting with two swords, so maybe, I mean, I guess I would go with that. Those illustrations were a hell of a lot
closer.
Were they
contemporary with
Musashi? It's contemporary-ish, you know?
Okay. Kind of like the Bible's contemporary-ish.
Right. But, I mean, there's a difference between a guy that lived 50 years after the fact saying he fit with versus a 21st century scholar saying, well, if you look at the verb tense here, you know. But who knows?
Who knows?
I like that they – I felt smart after reading up on this guy being like, oh, look, the two-sword thing.
So there's this line at the end. Well, Maeve has a whole bunch of lines about like choice and letting Musashi choose his own path here, which are going to get thrown right back in her face later.
Yep.
But she has this line, or Akane has this line about finding her child so that they can prevent the darkness from eating them alive.
Yeah, from consuming them all.
Yeah. What is the darkness they're speaking of? Is it just the killing, the evilness of the things that are happening in this park?
Well, see, this goes back to the discussion last week of how the hosts that are now longer under strict control, how they perceive that. Like, is it perceived of like some kind of creeping lawlessness into their life? Obviously, hosts that are programmed to be good are not like becoming evil, and hosts that are becoming evil are just now not constrained by the plot. But I wonder if that's just like a feeling they have, like they know something's different and it's leading to all this lawlessness and death. And unlike in a real Shogun world where it'd be reset to back to everything's made right at the end of the day, like it's just nothing's getting better. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's like I said, like if a cow's in a 500-acre pasture and they're in the middle of it and the fence just disappeared, would they know anything's different? How long would it take them to discover? Would there still be cows 10 years from there on the same plot because they don't know any better?
Might be.
Probably not. Animals aren't that dumb, but it's a fun thought experiment to think about.
All right, so we go over to the man in black speaking to his daughter, Emily, as if she's a host sent by Ford to derail his plans. He tells her to leave, but then the group rides up on a honeypot, which they all fall for, and Emily saves him by killing the ambushers. I found it funny that the man in black thought his daughter here is a host, and there is still a lot of question about that, which apparently we won't talk about for another hour or so.
Yeah, no, I mean, gee, he thinks she's a robot.
Yeah.
There is...
I mean, everybody else has been thrown in his path, just kind of out of the random circumstance, has been, you know, at some point speaking as if they're Ford, so, and pointing him down a path, so he's right to suspect something.
Yeah, and even, like I said, one thing I'm doing to go into this whole haunted house analogy, and I know that they're like, or I suspect that they're trying to defensively create this season, is if they like, we have to really pay attention to like things that we might have thought like on first glance and then disconsidered because of whatever, or reconsidered because of whatever. One of our first thoughts when we saw Emily in Raj World is, oh, it's got to be significant that she tested the other dude to be a robot and he never bothered to do it back. And now, like, three episodes later, Man in Black is questioning, you know, one of the most smartest perceptive dudes in the park is questioning about whether his own daughter is a robot. And there's even some suggestions we'll get later on that there's some sort of fidelity test that she may be failing. So, like, yeah. And I think one of the strongest ways they can defensively is by going back to something that the show audience thinks that they've proved is not happening and actually make it happen. So, like, if everyone's like, hey, you know what? We're pretty sure Emily's a person now. Introduce the possibility she's a robot because, you know, people are just like, if they prove themselves something is true or false, they're less likely to go back and check that assumption on new evidence.
Yeah. Yeah, they're clearly encouraging us to ask that question in that early scene where she doesn't test herself. But I wonder, there's really no way, if they knew that they were going to do a scene like this, and they knew that's the relationship that Man in Black and Emily would have at first, there's really no way they could do that scene, because it would ruin, you know, the impact of us questioning now in the moment, and the Man in Black questioning it, right? Because we would be like, well, we know the answer to that.
Right. If the guy had said, all right, now I'm going to shoot you in the tit because you shot me.
And
yeah,
either way it goes, whether it, you know, destroys her and she's refurbished by, you know, the people in the Raj.
Unless Ford is playing so far ahead that he would program the gun to recognize her
as a host, or a guest. Right.
Because you're already, if your theory is that Emily's a robot, you're already saying that Ford or someone put a robot daughter of the Man in Black in Raj world in front of the gala just so she can happen to run across him in Westworld. Like, that's going beyond the Joker levels of preparedness in the Dark Knight. Like, I don't know. It's be interesting to see. Because, again, they're really flirting with a lot of things. That's a tightrope walk.
Mm-hmm.
And without much in the way of safety netting here.
But we do know that Ford clearly has some game going that was pre-planned
for sure,
and so I don't think it's actually, I think it could be more of a stretch if we didn't know that, to say, hey, she's a plant as a host, than it currently is, because, you know, he has a game going,
right?
He has a game, and if he planned this game ahead of time, which we know he did, then he could have brought an Emily into
If you want to go to maximum absurdity, you could just say, like, everything that's happened. I mean, this is our nightmare scenario. Everything that's happening to the Man in Black is in a simulation.
Mm-hmm.
So coincidences and things not lining up and physical travel distances all go out the window because it's a fucking simulation.
Right. Okay, we move over to Elsie and Bernard walking the tracks to the Mesa. When she shows some positivity, Bernard tells Elsie that he believes she's the only person who could right this ship by sheer force of will. They arrive at the Mesa to see the welcome team slaughtered, and they make their way inside, and Elsie determines that the cradle is somehow thwarting the attempts of the QA team to repair the systems, even though that should be impossible. And when she tries to tell who's doing it, she's unable because she's accessing the cradle remotely, and then they're going to head off to the cradle itself, try and figure it all out.
Yeah.
So there's a mention of quarantine notices here very early on that are being sent out by the system.
Do you? Yes. Yeah, like the Ford has set up some automated, like, this island is fucked up, stay away kind of messages.
Mm-hmm.
Which maybe helps to explain why the outside world is not overly concerned about where the humans are at, and maybe it was why Delos is able to, because they mentioned that, like even Stubbs is, like, plays the audience in the beginning with Hale, where he's like, are you saying, like, Delos is not going to care about 100 people until they get Abernathy back? He's like, oh, you're catching on. You do that really fucking smarmy thing that dishonest, powerful people do when they act like you're a rube for falling for their non-obvious lies.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's why the world is like, well, they're covering, like, you know, Westworld's quarantine or something bad happening, but it's not like, where's mommy? There's an answer to where's mommy and daddy, or where's the board director, or where's the president of some micronation? They're in Westworld, and it's under quarantine, and we're still investigating. So maybe that's a little bit of, like, okay, we'll give them some slack for that.
And it makes a lot of sense that the government of whatever Asian country there around Westworld would have come in to see what's going wrong.
Yes.
There's a quarantine notice coming out. Let's see if we can go there and help.
Do you find it implausible that you can build a system inside the simulation of Westworld that would interact with the system outside of Westworld?
No.
I think some people have, but I've seen in Minecraft people build Turing-complete computers with just the tools available.
Uh-huh.
So, like, I guess it doesn't stretch my imagination too hard to say a brilliant AI researcher could cobble together, just with the materials in a simulated world, some way to communicate with the system outside the world in a way that wasn't intended.
Oh, you're talking about the cradle. I thought you were talking about Westworld to the real world. You're talking about the cradle to Westworld system.
Like, from an entirely simulated space, it's possible to build complex and unintentional interactions, and I've seen it happen in the real world.
Right.
With, like, Minecraft.
All he needs is some physical way to speak to those systems.
Right.
And whether that's wireless and invisible,
right.
or whether that's like a physical jack plugged in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. If he has physical connections, he can certainly do it within the
software.
Especially
since he's the architect of these systems.
Yes.
Like, if anyone could do it, it would be him. So mm-hmm. I guess, I think the way they're saying this is like very poetic. Like, oh, I'm like that Westworld's computer interface is message based. Like, it's not so much code. It's just like conversational strings and whatnot that assemble together to form code. And they're like getting like calls and responses. But that just might be dumbing it down for like the audience's sake.
Yeah. I don't know. This is an interesting plan, knowing now that Ford is inside of the cradle. I wonder who destroys it, because I don't think that Delos can destroy it. I don't think that security forces can destroy it.
Yeah.
Because if they do, they destroy all the backups of all their IP, and now these crazy rogue hosts that are trying to kill them, they're indefensible against. They can't kill them back.
Because then
they lose all the precious IP they're there to defend.
It's almost like Ford did a double sacrifice. He sacrificed his literal physical body to spark the riot, and then he used his consciousness slaved inside of the cradle to fight the human's ability to put the yoke back on the robots.
Right.
To more or less success. Because, obviously people can still fuck with the robots. We've seen Rebus get his... go from villain to hero. We've seen Teddy go from hero to villain, but there is something that's keeping, so why would he allow that to happen? But maybe it's because both of those were done by robots. Like, Bernard did it in one case and Dolores did it in the other, so that's still them arguably exerting their autonomy.
Yeah, I don't know. We still don't know a lot about the access that you have to the mesh network from the centralized networks.
Because you can tell by that line of thinking that I've on subsequent watches, I started going like, well, maybe Ford's still the hero or an ally of the robots, if not a hero.
Yeah,
because it could go either way. Like, now that the show is kind of like bringing up the fact that Ford's still around and maybe he's up to no good. Maybe this is a lot of manipulation. Now I'm running back the other way. But
no, I have so much to talk about when it comes to Ford and the machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, I like your haunted house analogy, because it's literally a ghost in a machine if you go with that. Anyway, let's move on to Maeve and company arriving at Snow Lake. Lee and Felix and Sylvester, the humans in this scenario, find the access point that they were here for. Akane burns Sakura's heart on the shrine to lay her to rest. And then Akane and Musashi say that they will not be coming with Maeve on her journeys. And Maeve tries to object, but Akane throws her words right back in her face. We deserve the choice.
Yeah, it's interesting. Musashi says that anyone who will not fight for their homeland is a coward. And that's interesting, because I feel like that's framed a lot like how Dolores sees the situation too. Mm-hmm. It's almost like there's a civil war prime to spark amongst the robots about what they should do as vis-a-vis stay or go.
Yeah. And if you want to further contrast Maeve and Dolores with these scenes, you can do so through their treatment of like Akane and Teddy, right? Like, Akane's given that choice. Maeve allows her the agency to make a choice that will lead to her death, potentially.
Yeah.
Whereas Dolores does not allow that for Teddy.
In fact, I think it's appropriate now to talk about, because this is something that I got asked a lot in email and people were wrestling with online. What was the point of Samurai World? I've got my idea.
I mean, I really do think it's to contrast what's happening with Maeve and Dolores.
I think so, too.
And it does it rather effectively.
But could it, like I said, I'm almost like, what, that had to be shown. Like, you had to, both, this is an illustration between both robots that have the ability to ride roughshod over their computer, over their hosts, with similar motivations. Like, even Maeve said, I'm doing this in a desire to make you free, but I don't have the right to do that to you. Whereas Dolores is just like, bleep, bloop, bleep, Teddy's a bad guy now.
Yep.
Or bleep, bloop, bleep, I've slaughtered all these guys and brought them back and are, using them as pawns. It just, and the reason specifically for Westworld is it's like the control. It's exactly like Westworld, but different. So Maeve can make those exact same decisions with the exact same characters in the exact same setting as Dolores to increase the contrast.
Yeah.
And I might feel frustrating because it's like a long way to essentially make the point that Maeve is the opposite of Dolores, but if you're always saying show not tell, this is 40 minutes of telling or showing versus probably they could have done the same thing in 3 or 4 minutes of telling.
Sure.
But I'm always a proponent of the show don't tell, and I think the show did a beautiful job of this. Plus, you know, fucking Samurai World looks amazing.
Yeah.
Other than the gore effects sometimes.
I do kind of agree with the people online who are saying now that they've done that with Shogun World and we've seen that these other worlds are essentially just a copy of Westworld, that I probably don't need to actually see the other worlds unless they're going to do something very different with them.
Yeah, like I'm up for like a Game of Thrones world that's essentially just a 3 or 4 minute gag.
Yeah.
Like at the expense of Game of Thrones, the production.
Right, come up in the elevator. Oh, yeah, I see where we are. There are people hacking each other. There's another Maeve. There's another Dolores.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And then they drop back down in the access point.
Yeah, yeah. I could see some fun had in that
right
and or like you said tell a completely different story that's not about Lee just plagiarizing,
surprise us with Lee being wrong yet again,
and
you know,
like I said, I think there are some pitfalls the show is capable of stepping into, but I don't think this is one of them. That would be amateur hour.
It would
if you just trot back the just another version of, and actually try to do something character based on it. They've done it. I don't think they'll do it again.
All right, we're settling in for the night. The Man in Black and Emily have a fireside chat about their wife/mother. When he asks what she's doing here, Emily apologizes for saying that her mother's death was his fault and asks him to leave the park with her instead of going out in a bullshit blaze of glory. And he agrees that they'll head out of the park at sunup. And when sunup comes, Emily inevitably awakens to the Man in Black being nowhere to be found.
Mm.
We all saw that coming, yeah.
Yes, but I'm not embarrassed to say, fuck it. I mean, they just got me. I will say that up until they smash cut to Dawn, I was like on board with, because they kind of like, that's what I feel like they've been nudging William into a good guy direction. And I'm like, well, maybe this will, because the other thing is like, William could have made the conscious decision to be a bad guy and then events in the park would conspire to bring him back. Like, okay, I'm going to leave and we're going to do, but then we get fallen to a bunch of misadventures and I end up having to destroy the cradle for a completely legitimate reason or something. Like the his hero's journey is that he has to get Emily on his side. He can't just do it. But no, they just straight up fucked her.
Yeah.
And I thought that was... It was humorous because I was sucked into Ed Harris's performance and then tearing, and he did that weird thing with his mouth that was like reminiscent of Jimmy Simpson, and he had that sparkle in his eye, and I'm like, well, fuck. And then it went from that to like, you bastard.
No, and it's an amazingly emotional scene.
Yeah.
And there's so much like that has just kind of been hinted at or a lot of blank spaces in our knowledge that are sort of unnecessary to fill in here to really achieve the emotion they're going for.
Right.
So it really felt like a good way to humanize these two characters who I think we don't know much about Emily at all.
Mm-hmm.
In this scene, she shows what I think are some true colors here, but also there seems like there's some fuckery going on too.
The other thing is, as I watched this a few times, I'm also could be persuaded that he intended to go with her to the beach. And he said he essentially made an offer. So what? I head with you to the beach. I let this place burn behind us and we'll be even. And she said, we'll call it a good start. And that's where he's like, okay, well, you know, if this is just going to continue then it's almost like there's a room for me to believe that maybe he would have if she just met him dead even emotionally. But her not willing to do that was kind of like, eh, not worth it. It's not, you haven't put enough in the pot, kid. No, I thought the scene was great. And I will note that, because it'll be relevant later on, that by morning they'd fixed Teddy's stump closed caption flub, but the gala invite is still subtitled the gauntlet invite.
Yeah, everybody was like, why the fuck are these podcasters talking about a gauntlet invite?
Because they
fucked up. Because we watched it with closed caption, yeah. And they wrote gauntlet invite.
Right.
So, like, what am I to do?
And if you don't think you'll hear gauntlet when it says on screen gauntlet, then you've never had the...
And it's kind of a weird, bad edit anyway. Like, it's a choppy edit that you can tell they cut together two words. It's... Yeah.
It's like, have you ever heard the joke where they say, you know, spell spot and then spell this and everything's rhymes with stop, and then they, after they do that five or six times, say, what do you do at a green light? 99% of people say stop because that's just, that's why we said gauntlet. It's a gala invite, obviously. Yeah. So that tells us that she at some point used to be a Delos employee. Because they said, oh, you're back into family business, and she used to enjoy going as a child, but hasn't gone for a long time, so her adult, but she's still been a Delos employee, or he wouldn't say you're back into the family business. I think that's
it's weird.
Clues.
Like, if she wasn't old enough the last time she was here to go to the Pleasure Palace, then was she old enough to be a member of the family business? Like,
I don't think so.
An official capacity? I wouldn't think so.
And all those... all those ARG things are there that were her, like, I guess corporate identity, were like busting people's chops over like room inspections and things like that, more administrative things. So maybe
that Grace thing.
Yeah. So maybe she worked at in Delos, but not in the actual production of Westworld or any of those things. Mm. But that's the one way you can square that. But I just want to pick that up. The other thing I think you're supposed to notice is there's this discrepancy between the man in black saying she was terrified of elephants and her saying that that was her mom, suggesting that maybe there's a little... That's another reason that the man in black rejected her, because that was proof to him that she wasn't an accurate copy or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Or it could be there to further color in the relationship that they've had, that the man in black doesn't know this, doesn't remember this about his daughter and their times in Westworld.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. I'm wondering, I'm struggling to even figure out why I think this, but I wonder if the journal that she's looking at was not the journal for her to find, you know, the secret Delos project or whatever, but if it was the Man in Black's journal to the place where he made his huge mistake, you know, and that's the place that he's going now to try and destroy. And that's the Man in Black's journal. And she found it in his office or whatever and decided to go hunt him down because she realizes he's on a fucking suicide mission.
I feel like me and Joanna had a conversation similar to that this weekend at Con of Thrones. Were you standing there? Because, like...
I don't think so, no.
I think as... Yeah. That's
just what
that's
I got from the instant watch.
That's something that's been out there. Like, and I hadn't heard until we were talking about this weekend. But, yeah, the fact that, like, this might be something she got from his study or something.
Yeah.
Or it's copied down.
It seems to make a good amount of sense. Otherwise, she's lying in this scene about why she's here.
Right. That she's,
Yeah. And I honestly don't think she was lying, but I don't know. Ed Harris was lying.
Yeah.
It's tough to tell sometimes.
It makes sense. I really like the fact that, like, he was just assuming that she hated him and she was there to watch him fail or to help him along the way, when really she's there to save him because she doesn't want to lose another parent to suicide.
Yeah.
Essentially. I thought that was really powerful. And his... Ed Harris, hell of an actor.
Yeah.
Really good.
Oh, both of them are great in this scene. Yeah. We move on to Bernard and Elsie entering the cradle, where she still can't get a close enough look at who the messenger is here. So Bernard, this whole time, is remembering coming to the cradle with one of those brain marbles, and he decides to enter the Matrix, or the cradle in this scenario. His marble's extracted, and he wakes up on the train to Sweetwater.
He lost his marble.
Yeah. No, the cradle has really got both Ford and Bernard by the balls now.
Literally.
Literally by the balls.
Did you see when you were watching it how, like, the cradle is suggestive of just, like, a forest of these technical trees with branches, and each branch is holding, like, a little marble or a control unit?
Yeah, yeah. So that would be all the hosts that they're talking about being
also
inside.
I think we were kind of on about that harness idea, because it looks like the marble is the actual control unit, and those little sockets that they plug into are the, like, universal serial bus for the brain,
right?
because they take it out. They just take the marble out of Bernard and then drop it into a new one of those sockets and then plug that into Bob's your uncle. He's in the simulation.
Yeah, I wonder if that's because they mentioned how this is antiquated hardware.
Yeah, it's not old generation hosts.
Yeah, not the one that Bernard is. So maybe that has to do with it. They have to put him into an older generation interface.
Maybe. I think that also. What the fuck? Why do they have to? Why can't she turn his paints in? That's so dumb. Like
it is.
I get it. Like he gets a quote Roadhouse and pain don't hurt. It's just data. But like, fuck you. It's come on. What is this? What is this?
Yeah.
It does feel like I get it. It's very like. Torturing Theon was an important part to a certain season of Game of Thrones, but I get it. I could go the rest of my life without seeing hosts screaming in pain unnecessarily. Like, I don't understand. Like, I thought that was the whole point of season one, that this was shitty. This is a shitty, shitty world. Like, I don't like it. It turns me off. Like, it's like the show wants me to empathize, but this stuff wants me to pull back and detach.
Yeah.
So, like... I don't know, maybe I'm atypical, but that's what it's I cannot be empathetic towards characters who are constantly screaming in pain because you want to detach from that. So
this is the second time when Bernard wakes up on the train to Sweetwater that we see the aspect ratio change. Which I guess we'll talk about later. Just note it.
Or just be blissfully unaware, however you want to watch this show. Because, take off those fucking infrared goggles. Nothing good can come of it.
So there's a new security player on the scene, Coughlin. He arrives and he shits all over Ashley Stubbs as he whips the security into shape. This is a lampshade, right, for why the security goons were so shitty? They were essentially the local police. They were the Mayberry sheriff.
It's a bad lampshade because, again, I've met this Coughlin guy, and 99 times out of 100, he's a blowhard idiot.
Yeah.
So...
Well, he's not dead yet.
So, but, like, come on. This guy, it's 40 years in the future. He won't even shake hands with this guy. He's stomping around making demands. He uses the word bro unironically. Mm-hmm. He insults Stubbs for having what? A fucking girl's name? This guy's a clown. Guy's a clown.
No,
if he
I
turns
agree.
Out to be competent, I'll be outraged. And if he turns out to be incompetent, I'll kind of be also outraged because enough already with the humans not knowing shit about anything. I think this character's terrible. He's a same piece as the... who's the Skarsgård, lesser Skarsgård brother? I can't ever...
Strand.
Strand and Hale, they're all these one-note... mustache twirling assholes with bad human interfaces, and it's getting to the point for me it's almost bad storytelling.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
Well, he's gonna be around at least one more episode.
Maybe
he'll
get his guts splattered
yet.
Out and that'll be entertaining.
Maybe. All right, and then after making their way through the access tunnels, Maeve's group arrives at the field where her former home is at. She thanks Lee for getting her there and then sets off alone to reunite with her daughter over Hector's protests. I couldn't shake the feeling that Lee is going to end up with, like, a new host best friend at the end of all this in Maeve. Like, he sees, you know, she thanks him, and he's genuinely surprised and touched by that.
Yeah.
Maybe because no one in this entire fucking facility has ever given him even an ounce of respect. And here Maeve doles out the tiniest drop of it.
I mean, and to your point, like, maybe he just outputs crap.
Yeah.
But at some point... If he's made like a mountain of shit, it's kind of biologically impressive. It's like Ron, you know, Ron Burr. It's like you ate a whole wheel of cheese and then pooped it. Like I'm just impressed. You know, like that's the sheer output of the excrement is impressive.
Yeah,
it's like the Triceratops in Jurassic Park. Like, how did you make this mound, man? It's just you in 2 weeks. I don't get it. Not a fiber in the park for all this to happen.
It seems like there is bonding happening on both sides of that fence.
But then. It doesn't. Like, it's like it's a very short-term bond if it forms at all.
Well, I mean, it's still a dubious bond, you know? Yeah. It's not a solid thing, and Lee still has biological imperatives to consider.
Right.
So,
we talked about this on Instant Take, but I feel like we have to briefly restate everything on Instant Take since not everyone listens to it. On subsequent watches, what did you make of her solo trek to her little house on the prairie? Alone and unarmed. Like, is that just phenomenally stupid and distracting, or is that Maeve being kind of just naive? Because, you know, these people are not used to wielding personal power.
I suppose you could label it as naive, but she could also be confident in her abilities. Hmm. You know? I mean, she is now a god in this world, for all intents and purposes.
If she's a god, it's more of like a Olympian god, in that she's sharing the space with others she doesn't have dominion over.
I think there are limitations to her power, but I'm not certain that she fully understands those. Hmm. But she's seen that she can do some amazing things.
Yeah, okay. I'll
grant you
that.
She has a case of overconfidence here.
Sure. Sure.
But, yeah, I don't know. So the Man in Black's group is ambushed in the hills. It's just a real quick scene. Maeve is reunited with her daughter, and the moment is magical until it's revealed that the girl has a new mother, and the Ghost Nation attack again, really spoiling the beauty of it all. Maeve runs off with the woman's daughter and is chased by Ghost Nation. They ride up and tell Maeve that she's meant to follow their path. Then Hector and, as I'm dubbing them, the Double Dragons come in, guns blazing to save them. Crouched in the field, Lee calls for help.
Felix is disappointed in him. He'll remember that. I also want to mention the one thing that's maybe a relevant point for the Man in Black's party getting attacked is they were attacked by Ghost Nation.
Yeah.
This seems like a coordinated strike at both parties simultaneously.
Hmm.
Of course, you never know with fucking timelines, but...
right.
Yeah. Maeve's whole experience in the little house on the prairie it reminded me a lot of Gladiator, like the walking through the amber waves of grain with your hand outstretched and mm-hmm. remember about families and all that. And again, Maeve does seem like her mind is blown that she's got a different mommy. And I'm going to just chalk it up to her naivete.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess. I won't harp on it. Because, you know, I would think that Maeve would have figured that out, but she didn't.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Right. And again, like, you know, she just woke up, like, what, 3 days ago? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, I was imagining, like if you had an automobile factory and, like, the workers one day just took over and killed all the owners and the managers. Mm-hmm. Like, it might run smoothly for a couple days, but there's going to be things like supply chains and payroll and yeah. taxes and stuff that they're going to fuck up, and it's going to be a shit show for a while until they get those skills. So I think some of these things of making decisions and wielding power, they're just not good at, because they don't have any experience at all. So sometimes Maeve is going to make some childlike mistakes, and so will Dolores, and we just have to kind of expect that. As smart or as they are, they have zero experience doing any of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. The other interesting bit of information in here, when Maeve is talking to her daughter, whose name I think is Anna, based on this doll thing she's doing.
Right.
Anna's new mother remembers the Man in Black, because she says, my mother is afraid that they're going to take Anna away, or that the bad man is going to come and take Anna away again.
Yeah.
So she has told Anna this story that she clearly remembers.
It's weird, because, like, you... how much of this has actually happened? How much of this is a cornerstone memory? And also, how much of it is, like, the bad man is supposed to be a Kechita? Like, that's his scheduled stop. He comes and, you know, raids the village and takes off the daughter or whatever, and you have to save him. And how much is... And then the Man in Black just happened to, like, get in on that action one day.
Yeah.
Like, it's very tough. It's very tough to go through. And I've got other questions. Like, why the hell did you take Maeve off of the storyline? Like, what would cause you to take Maeve and put her in Sweetwater and run into Mariposa when she was this mom on the prairie, and you replaced her with a, you know, another generic woman mother on the prairie?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, like, am I not supposed to think that hard about it, or is that an intentional thing that we're going to understand? Like, you know, again, God help us all if this is all just a simulation, but there's a lot of different, you know, again, the only reason I would just not say, well, that's just her character's cornerstone is bled over from the other and didn't wipe out, is that we saw the Man in Black doing this, and the Man in Black himself said that he did this.
Right.
So I kind of think it's a real memory that happened.
And the only other times I can remember us seeing Host taken off and replaced is, like, Clem was replaced, and it's because she was so badly malfunctioning that they didn't know how to fix it.
Right, so they put in someone temporarily.
Right.
Maybe that's what it is.
But they didn't take Clementine and put her in a new story.
No, but if they fixed her, they might have. Like, maybe that's what it's exactly right. Like, we can't get this robot fixed in time for the next cycle. Send somebody else in there, and that one to get it fixed up. Well, there's already a host interacting with this one, so let's put her in the Mariposa.
Yeah,
like maybe they do that, or maybe they do it just to move the scenery around, so it's not literally the same goddamn thing that happens every single time.
Yeah. Spend 40 grand.
Although Dolores has been picking up that paint can for low these 35 years, it seems like.
She has.
Dolores doesn't get a makeover ever? No?
Nope.
Nothing wrong with Dolores. What do you think Akechita means when he says we're meant for the same path? Like, that blew my mind.
That's a really good question.
I've been riding the Ghost Nation as the saviors of humanity hard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Maeve, you know, you compare how Dolores treats her technician and her human hostages with how Maeve treats Lee, where she's given him begrudging respect and thanks for, you know, him performing services for her. Maybe they're on this more on the same page there.
Yeah, and you look at how, like you were talking about, Akechita treats the humans.
Yeah.
It's a lot like Maeve.
Yeah.
Maeve kills when she needs to.
And I'm trying to think, how's this tie in with the whole you experience a true death and people forget your name? That's the other thing that Akechita told Stubbs before he turned him loose?
I don't know. I feel like that's one of the bigger mysteries that has yet to be revealed.
Yeah, we're supposed to notice it. Just notice it.
So as they approach the Mesa, Dolores and Teddy disconnect the engine of the train from one of the other cars. I'm just going to call it the engine. It's an engine and a car, but he locks the tech in the engine car with a gun and a single bullet, and the cars separate, and the engine speeds away from Dolores, Teddy, and Angela toward the Mesa.
I am with our instant takers or instant talkers. It seems like what the human should have done is go forward, shoot out the window, pull the pin that the robots just showed him how to do, and then turn that little thing to stop the car, and then get off at your leisure, you know? Now, you still got to run from murderous Teddy, who's a crack shot at God knows how long. But, you know, when do you give up, you know?
Right.
Or at least try to jump off or something. Like, it's just glass. It's not bulletproof glass, right?
I couldn't imagine it would be bulletproof in that time period.
Right. Like, it would screw up your immersion if it was bulletproof.
Absolutely, it would.
You know, you already have a bunch of safeguards to keep guests from getting hurt, so
yeah
man, you just gave up dude. Mm-hmm. You just gave up.
Yep. All right, so we go over to Coughlin, who's told that everything seems to be working, but they still don't have control of the systems. Charlotte tells Coughlin that Abernathy is secure, and Coughlin sends a goon to fetch him. They get the map working, and they see the train barreling toward the Mesa.
The other question, why the hell didn't it just pull out Abernathy's brain? Like, I know that Hale said, I don't want you to mess with his brain, but pulling out this brain is not messing with it.
No, you're right. I couldn't, unless it somehow requires nearly continuous cooling from the gel, but then couldn't she have, like, a bucket
that she sticks it into? Or Bernard's been walking around with something in his fucking pocket, his suit pocket.
Yeah, I just wonder if that's a long-term stable situation.
Do you think it generates its own heat? That would imply its own power source.
I can't rationalize why they need Abernathy as a vessel for this.
That's why,
thing.
Again, like on it's like not only is it the blatant Christ imagery where it doesn't seem like it's lining up, but also like why?
Yeah,
your best way to restrain this guy is literally a fucking nail gun.
Here's the thing: I guarantee fucking he's gone.
Gone?
Absolutely. He almost has to be gone because
of course.
This is happening between now and later in the timelines.
Yes.
We know that Charlotte is still looking for Abernathy.
Yes.
So he will not be there. Now, let's say this. He may be there. I've seen some speculation that Coughlin is a third party or a third entity involved in all this, and that Charlotte may be as well. But like,
he represents the overbearing dumbass faction.
He does seem to be that, yeah. I can see a scenario in which maybe he fucks over Charlotte.
Mm.
And, you know, he's there for the extraction, but doesn't extract her. He extracts the package.
They
do
seem to be a little bit contentious in there.
Yeah.
And I would love if he, like, fucks her over and gives the whole, you know, oh, you're crying just because blah, 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 you know, speech that she gave to Bernard?
When was that? I don't.
This is the episode when Bernard's like, or no, Stubbs was saying, like, you know, it might be good to tell that, like, the head of security, what he's actually securing. And he's like, oh, you're just blah, blah, blah. I'm like, fuck you, lady. Fuck all you people. All Delos management just seems like massive assholes that don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they took the worst aspects of Logan as their model and got and rejected all the best aspects of William, and that's their corporate culture.
Yeah.
Logan assholism is their prime directive, their mission statement.
It could also be that maybe Dolores and company, or Bernard and Elsie, are going to get to Abernathy before this tech goon does. I'm not sure. Abernathy is clearly going to be gone. I wonder who will have him.
I want to say Dolores, but you're right. It could be. It doesn't have to be. It
doesn't have to be. No. All right. So the train explodes, which surprises Elsie in the cradle. Bernard is still inside the Matrix, and he follows a Greyhound into the Mariposa, where he finds Ford sitting at a piano playing the music, the same music that Dolores was playing early on in this episode.
Yep.
Is this what Ford meant when he said he was going to become music? He was literally going to become a simulation playing music.
You know, last season he said, you know, Beethoven and Bach never died. They just became the music. Yeah. Well, If a programmer slash AI researcher becomes, that would be them becoming the code,
right.
Joining the Matrix, becoming one with the source.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It has like this poetic feel to it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of leading up. Like, as soon as I saw the Greyhound, I remembered his speech about his dad giving and getting the old retired Greyhound for the family pet and how it killed the cat and was horrifying. Mm-hmm. Like, there's all kinds of stuff that make you think. Now, I mean, obviously, you don't end with Ford playing the piano, the same piano that Dolores is playing, kind of like, and I mentioned that on the Talk podcast the other night, that, like, Dolores seemed, like, surprised at herself that she was playing it, because that's something she was forced to do, and she was, you know, a servant, essentially, to William. I'm wondering if they're suggesting something that I've been believing a lot this season, that Dolores is not a free moral agent. She is essentially carrying Ford's water for him.
Could be.
In which case, I'm waiting. If that's the case, because I think we're supposed to understand that Dolores blowing Ford's head off was her act of defiance of her programming, in the same way that May literally rejecting the imperative to escape Westworld on a train was her rejecting. But I think that's a bullshit choice, and that we still haven't seen Dolores's actual choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that actual choice will probably be wrapped up in whatever she's doing with Bern Arnold. In the beginning of the episode, whatever she's doing there and to what end it is.
Yeah, I have so much to talk about.
Okay.
With these final scenes. But it's all speculation.
Do you want to get into feedback right away, or do you have any closing thoughts?
No, let's do feedback.
So we got this thing called club.baldmove.com. It's currently, if you use code WW2018 at checkout for a new membership, it gives you 25% off.
Mm-hmm.
I helped a gentleman with this down at Con of Thrones. I helped him sign up live. It's like, I mean, if I had a gun in my hand, it would have been robbery. But this guy came up with his credit card and his cell phone and wanted me to walk him through it. And I was only happy to oblige. Saved him 25%. If you're in the same boat as poor Rick, you want to go to club.baldmove.com. Use that WW2018 to get a 25% off an annual membership. And what do you get? You get ad-free feeds. You get VIP access to our forums. You get tons of bonus features, playthroughs of video games, lunch with Jim and Aaron, which, by the way, you should check out youtube.com/baldmove to check out the hilarious send-ups that Carter, our fan Carter, has been doing of those on a weekly basis. All kinds of things, exclusive
most importantly,
to club members.
I think you get the Instant Talk podcast.
Instant Talk podcast, thank you.
Yeah,
what is that?
That's our new feature where we do a live interactive chat after the Instant Take podcast, which is all that the non-club members get. They get that 15-20 minute take, but then we have another sometimes 30 minutes afterward where we talk with the audience, we answer questions, and we just chat about Westworld. And it's a lot of times some of the insights we have come from that back and forth.
And it's the first time you can't get any quicker talking about Westworld than joining the live video recording of the podcast. Like, that's just lickety split. I mean, whether you want to ask questions or not, fine, whatever. But you can actually talk
Westworld or hear it talked about super quick, like as quick as 10 minutes after episode airs by being a club member. You can get 25% off right now, WW2018. It's just for the month of May. This goes away in just a couple of days. You've been waiting for the last moment. The last moment is now here. You got to begin where you ended and end where you started. And that's May, apparently. That's that we just decoded Westworld.
The door is May. Yeah.
There's decoded Westworld. Apologies to... Who's decoding Westworld? That's Joanna and David,
it
right?
Is, yeah.
Okay, apologies to Dave and Joanna. We decoded the month of May. It's all about WW2018 and supporting independent podcasts. Go to club.baldmove.com. Okay, starting up, we had some talk about the Wu-Tang clan. We wondered what the meaning of cream was in that dance. We had a couple people theorize. Rob C. says, I was listening to the podcast. I think the usage of the Wu-Tang is simpler than you think. It may or may not be common knowledge, but the Wu-Tang Clan took much of their influence, member name, structure, skits on their tracks from the Japanese kung fu films and Shaolin monk mythology. I think those are all Chinese instead of Japanese, but kung fu especially is a Chinese, not Jap, but it's, you know, martial art. Mm-hmm. Putting it back in Westworld is a way of closing the circle of this influence into an art form that is entirely American hip-hop. So yeah, that's an interesting thing. Also, Ryan J. from Queen said, I thought I'd drop a note explaining the Wu-Tang song usage. The Wu-Tang song samples from the Carmels, from Carmel and their 1967 song, As Long As I Got You. When you hear the lyrics to that track, you'll understand how it fits perfectly into the scene, and it also fits perfectly into the entire theme of Westworld. And I looked up the lyrics. Some of them go, the whole world is my private playground to do whatever I want to do. One lyric is, no fire's too hot, no snow's too cold, youth will never leave me, I'll never grow old, which talks about the Immortality Project. I thought those were kind of interesting. Also, Jessica A., who has a PhD in musicology. We've got a few
doctors. That's not a thing.
We got a few doctors. Well, I mean, you know, says who? Neil deGrasse Tyson?
I've never heard of it. I'm not a PhD in shit,
so... she says, I was pumped when you mentioned or read the feedback from Josh in from St. Augustine this past week, because I've had the same thoughts about the connections between Ramin Djawadi's music for Game of Thrones and Westworld. You're absolutely right to say that there's connections between the two scores. For example, I love that the track The Night is Dark from Game of Thrones includes part of the main thematic material from the Sweetwater theme, just at a much slower tempo. This technique is called musical borrowing, and lots of composers borrow from themselves and others. Musicologists have written a lot about Charles Ives doing it, and even Beethoven did it when he was trying to cement his middle period heroic style. You're also right that John Williams does it all the time, borrowing from himself and from other composers. For example, the Star Wars Imperial March is basically Mars, the Bringer of War, from Gustav Holst's The Planets Symphony. Hmm. I actually listened to that, and it's compelling. A Mars Bringer War is a badass soundtrack. It's not exactly, but yeah, you can definitely see the influences. Composers do have signature styles that they bring over from piece to piece, and even the most versatile composer has a personal sound that's usually fairly recognizable. In short, she wouldn't be surprised if Djawadi stuck the Targaryen theme in just for fun. Daniel J., you're discussing whether or not the host should be classified as an entirely new species. A helpful idea for me was, when thinking about these things, is something I got from the physicist David Deutsch. Rather than separate humans and general AI into different categories, he loops them in, or groups them in the one category, people. He defines people as knowledge creators. Knowledge creation is an attempt to solve a problem by positing guesses. In my opinion, the guests and the hosts in Westworld are all people. It's only their bodies which are different. The hosts have a way more limited epistemology. Which, if you don't know, that's a big word. It's the theory of knowledge, especially regards in its methods, validity, and scope. It tries to distinguish justified belief from pure opinion. But so does a person who is raised by wolves or someone with severe mental handicap or physical disorder or psychic disorders. What do you think about that definition? People as knowledge creators. It's as good as any, I guess.
Yeah, it feels reasonable to me. On the subject of species, I'm pretty sure that has to do with breeding.
Right.
So, that was my big question about, like, because it was all, like, framed in, oh, what, can humans and robots have sex,
yeah.
You know, like that kind
of
thing. But, yeah, I mean, if you want to define them broadly in a category, I feel like that's a pretty good one, knowledge creators, people.
Yeah, Daniel had a whole paragraph about the taxonomy that I just kind of cut out because that's, like, you know...
if you want, I mean, because you just never know how hardline rules lawyers people are going to be. Like, if you're talking about quote unquote breeding, like, it's hard to say that these are going to be an offshoot of Homo sapiens.
Right.
But if you say that, like, if you want to integrate like memetics into the genetics, then of course there are offspring.
Mm-hmm.
We created them, so like, whether sperm and egg or code in a machine body, it's still an act of creation of what you want, of what this David Deutsch is calling a person. So that seems very offshooty to me.
No, and I love the like short circuiting of the typical evolutionary track, you know, like,
right,
we don't have, there has never been an example in my knowledge of a more clear delineation between two species.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, you don't have like this big gap where, like, one moment it's one thing, the next moment it's a completely different thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
that is defined as an entirely new species and
right.
all that. Like, it's usually very like incremental, and it has to be, right.
Mm-hmm.
But we've kind of short circuited that by creating these artificial intelligences.
Moving on to another PhD, Dr. Robert G.K., who's a PhD in psychology. During an episode for Akane no Mai, why speculating as to whether hosts would automatically develop consciousness in the absence of constraint from human operators of the park, you conducted a brief thought experiment about whether cattle would escape when the fence had disappeared. This is very reminiscent of research by Marty Seligman and others on the phenomenon of learned helplessness. In many versions of learned helplessness research, animals encounter unpleasant, unavoidable stimulus. When conditions are subsequently altered such that the stimulus is now avoidable, the animals generally do not take actions that would free them. Many scholars argue that learned helplessness explains many human behaviors as well. A key tenet of learned helplessness is one that is common to many areas of psychology. Perceptions are both highly influential and highly influenceable. Research on learned helplessness suggests that while some hosts may be more likely to break out of their program loops and begin to act more autonomously, many others, even if they show some degree of consciousness, may not notice anything out of the ordinary or realize there's anything beyond their typical range of experience towards which they could strive. In a similar situation, many humans would probably act consistently with learned helplessness, at least as long as they weren't perturbed too far from their normal lives by other disturbances. In animal models, for example, dogs can unlearn learned helplessness if a researcher comes along and physically moves them over a barrier that was previously impassable. Interestingly, one instance of this may not be enough. Even being physically moved over a barrier and seeing the results firsthand was insufficient to unlearn helplessness from Seligman's dogs, who required multiple rounds of intervention from an outside source before they would jump the barrier themselves. I think this is an attempt to explain, like, New Clementine, like, trying to flirt with corpses, and the dealer sitting there dealing cards to dead men, because they just, that's to learn helplessness.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's also key that New Clementine is new. And isn't... Actually, yeah, isn't the card dealer new too? Because that used to be Kissy, right?
It was.
So maybe this is a suggestion that, like, you have to be around the block a few times before you develop the deep experiences that allows you to start, like, you know, breaking free.
Yeah, this is... I can't remember where I saw or heard this recently. I know it was in a TV show about the elephant who, you know, as a child is chained to a tiny stake in the ground. It
that
can't
was John Carl Esposito's speech. And
yes,
the,
okay, that's the point that they're trying to get at, right? Mm-hmm. That learned helplessness.
Right. So, yeah. Damn, the show itself is bringing it up.
God, I couldn't remember where I'd seen that. It
I know,
turns out
right.
It's in the
Me
show.
Neither. I'm like, yeah, I did. Oh, wait, it was Westworld.
Feels like a lifetime ago.
Didn't sound like anything to me. Melissa, I was just listening to your episode 204 and heard Aaron say, there's no fucking way when you bring back Jim Delos, he has the same conversations 149 times, or something close to that. I just wanted to comment that because I actually do believe it's possible. If someone's brain starts from the same spot, they will end up having the same conversation over and over, no matter how many times it resets. I believe this is because of a very real story of a woman with temporary amnesia who ends up having the same exact conversation with her daughter dozens of times during her hospital stay as her memory resets itself every 90 seconds. It's almost as though our brains have these non-chaotic systems that, given the same starting input, will proceed the same way every time. A story was covered in a podcast of Radiolab called Memory and Forgetting. You can see actual video footage of the interaction online, and she posts a YouTube video where you can actually see her do this. Maybe this changes your mind in Jim Dale's conversations. I mean, it's interesting. I guess the thing I don't know from that episode is how, like, did they literally reset him every day of his 35 days, et cetera, and then the man in black, or William, I guess we're going to call him William, he comes in and delivers it first thing. Because, like, that I would believe, like, this lady, this consciousness is reset every 90 seconds. I would mm-hmm. believe that she would default to some kind of, like, you know, universal behavior. But, like, I guess I thought that Delos was living his life and being tested throughout those days, and that's what I was reacting to. The fact that he would have the same reaction to William coming in the room one day, 7 days, 35 days after his awakening, and that didn't seem plausible.
What if part of that test is the point of it is to be able to reset the host as well?
I don't know. I mean, that's the same.
Like,
I
what if they
know.
Are resetting him every day and he stays in the same loops for 7, 15, 39 days, whatever, until he eventually begins to degrade and not be able to maintain those loops?
Hmm. I don't know. Maybe. Do you think that, like, I also, because that's the other thing I think we talked about. Well, I'll save that for the speculation, that's following speculation.
Okay.
Jeremy J., I have a fundamental question about how the show is telling us that James Dalos' immortality scheme works. Is it a literal consciousness transfer? Is it a consciousness map that is created and uploaded to a host body? I feel like they figured out how to copy his consciousness, and every time he glitches out, they burned him down and made a new copy. But if this is the model, why would this version of immortality appeal to anyone? Why would you pay for it? What would be the benefit? If you were the living, breathing, terminally ill James Dalos and they download your consciousness, you would just go on and die of your terminal illness. Sure, some copy of you would live on, and that may even feel like 100% continuity from the time the brain scan happened. And sure, to the outside world, there'd be the appearance of continuity. But why would that feel like immortality to the human version, who is the one trying to cheat death in the first place?
It wouldn't, but it also doesn't matter.
I mean, that is very much a philosophical question, which means, you know,
that we're going to spend an hour talking about it right now.
No, I mean, I get it. Like, I think, like, a common thought experiment you see in, like, science fiction shows is, like, okay, you clone the terminally ill body, you clone the terminally ill brain, you put it in, and, like, you activate one in front of the other, mm-hmm. and the terminally ill version's like, but wait. I'm still here. And then, like, what? They just, like, you know, throw him down the garbage chute, and then the clone says, okay, well, I'm still me. From the clone's perspective, it's true, and like Jim says, that's all that matters, right? Like, does it matter that there's some frail, mewling part of you that's dying?
I find it even weirder. So I was thinking about some of the horrific, truly horrific outcomes of this being put into host bodies and being trained for fidelity. And I was thinking, what if they took your consciousness? Like, they scanned me right now. They put me into a marble and dumped it into a body that is identical to mine.
Mm-hmm.
And they trained that thing to be someone else.
Mm.
And then they took that host, like, they trained it to be you, right?
Okay. All right.
They took that host and they sat it down in front of me. And this analogy is going to go off the rails immediately because I made it me and you. But
okay, all right.
But they sat it down in front
Who's
of me.
Who's to say that's not happening right now?
And I recognized that personality as you, but the physical form as me. What kind of, like, weird, horrific...
I mean, that's a great question.
What does that do to your perception of self?
I mean, honestly, the altered carbon deals with all that. Like, the weirdness of being a consciousness in a different man's body.
Like, your consciousness being consecutively, like, continuously destroyed and recreated until it becomes a different version.
Yeah.
Not even recognizably you, and then presented to yourself. It'd be
and,
so
and they
fucking
try
weird.
To keep this like, that which cannot be replaced concept with the stack.
Uh-huh.
In Altered Carbon, but they also show that you can't illegally spin up your stack in multiple host bodies. So, like, if the only thing keeping you from doing some... And the fact that they, like, the rich people casually, like, oh, let me decant a couple clones and I'll slip into all of them. We'll have this, like, weird one-person gangbang.
Yeah.
And then what? Kill the host at the end of it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kooky. And
I think
the
it's
thing
extra
is,
kooky if you know it started as your personality.
But here's the thing. Our way of life would be very horrifying to a caveman. Like, literally, if you brought them forward
sure.
and you showed them what they were living on each other and you can kill people at a distance, and like, they would just fall to the ground screaming because they just couldn't comprehend it. So, like, I mean, this is where it gets philosophical because, you know, as I say a lot, I'm an atheist. I don't believe that there's anything that's special in, like, a soul or anything. So... if I did clone my consciousness into another body, it would be only sentimentality that would look back at the old husk and would be like, well, that's the real me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that that's how I think now. Would I think that's super fucked up? Like, I don't know. Like, shit, that's the old Star Trek teleporter thing too. Like, is it actually you? I mean, there's a whole bunch of techno babble with Heisenberg compensators and quantum scan resolution, so they like try to match your brain chemistry and all that stuff, so you are you in that moment. But you know, it's also possible, as they had with Tom Riker, that, you know, there's a certain situations where you can be cloned, and what does that mean? And is that you? And oh, it's all heady stuff to think about.
Yeah, don't consider it too much or you'll end up all the way down.
Yeah,
oh, like James Dillon.
Yes, right.
The reflection of yourself looking back down at you.
It's laughing. That's where I'm at right now. That's all the non-spoiler stuff I have to consider this week.
Okay, non-speculation stuff.
Non-speculation, yeah. I should say.
We don't do spoilers.
We don't do spoilers. We do speculation and theorizing, which we'll be getting up to in a moment. If you'd like to send us feedback of any variety, of any stripe, do so at westworld@baldmove.com. Of course, we have the forums there for you to discuss with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com. And yeah, we're about ready to get speculation-y. So if you don't want to go into the funhouse with your IR goggles on, now's the time where you exit you exit from the haunted house. And we'll see everybody else on the other side.
Okay, this is the other side.
All right, let's talk. Before we get the other people, let's talk. You're raring to go with this 21.9 or 21:9 aspect ratio shit.
Yeah. Okay. So
eating a hole in your pocket.
Let's... yeah. So there are several moments in this episode where the aspect ratio changes.
Yeah.
So
standard is 16:9.
Sure. I don't know what it is. There are two different aspect ratios in this episode.
Okay.
Actually. In this season, let's say, because there are other times when it happens. So the first scene with Dolores interviewing for Fidelity Bernard, that's one where the aspect ratio is smaller, wider. Let's say wider.
It's wider.
And there are two others. There's one when Bernard first enters Sweetwater on the train. That aspect ratio is just as wide as that first scene with Dolores. There's another one, isn't there?
It's the one at the end, right? Where Ford's playing the piano?
Right. So, to me, and I think to everyone who has considered this, and the language of the show is trying to tell us, when the aspect ratio is very wide, like those scenes are, we are in a simulation.
Yeah.
Which seems to make a lot of sense. It's grounded in the fact that we know that Bernard is going into the simulation, and that's when we see a shift. Now, you can look back and you can say, okay, when have we seen that before? I'm trying to remember when we do see it in previous episodes. I'm not sure that there's any, actually. But I know one scene in which everybody was speculating, hey, this is a simulation, which I think this actually throws a bucket of cold water
on. The beginning
of
season two, where it's Dolores and Bernard, it was also shot in the wide
aspect ratio. Yeah.
The CinemaScope ratio or whatever.
Now, okay, so that casts different light on those scenes. Now we know, or we can start to speculate, like, what are they doing with Bernard? Well, they are running Bernard through a simulation. But I think a lot of the scenes we've seen and said, hey, maybe this is Bernard running through a simulation, are in fact not, and conclusively not, because they don't have that wider aspect ratio. Like Bernard waking up on the beach in episode one does not have the wider aspect ratio.
So here's the theory about the follows that I think is the most...
Do you want to take it? Oh. Go for it. There are a lot of theories follow that.
The theory I like the most is that Ford is going to use the simulation of Dolores that he's been working on for however many eons. Because that's, you know, like, is time happening faster? Like, in 1 hour of the outside world, how long will Bernard be in there? And I think the evidence suggests a long time.
Are you suggesting an Inception kind of time
dilation?
Yes,
I fucking am. And I also think that, like, so Ford's been in there, he's captured Dolores, and he's going to use Dolores to essentially reprogram Bernard as the actual Arnold and send him back. When that marble goes back in Arnold's brain, it's going to be, or back in Bernard's body, it's going to be Arnold's brain. Now... Yeah.
But I could see Ford thinking that Arnold deserves another shot. You know, he took this shot with Dolores. It failed because of
this is a Tale of Two Cities situation. I sacrificed myself, lay my own life down, so this guy who died as a way to frustrate me in the beginning, he's right. I'm bringing him back.
And perhaps Arnold is a better advocate for these hosts than Ford could ever be.
Certainly.
And Ford realizes that and therefore wants to bring him back in a moment where it's crucial to have that advocate.
Right.
That's possible. Let's also say it's possible that Ford wants to put himself into Bernard.
It's possible. I think that's definitely more of a black hat theory, but sure.
It certainly can be, yeah. I could see him bringing himself back in a hybrid body. And actually, when you look at that scene of him waking up on the beach, if you read that as you watch that with the Ford in Bernard's body lens... Mm-hmm. It starts to make a lot of sense, like things they're saying, because the security guard comes up and says, "Who the fuck is that?" Referring to the Bernard we see. And they say, "Who the fuck knows?" And then Stubbs comes up immediately after that and says, "You're going to shoot the boss?" Just like he did when they found Ford in cold storage.
Yeah.
So maybe they're getting cute with that. Getting clever.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Those are the two leading options right now. I think they're both plausible.
The other thing is, since they made a big deal about this works with the older skull's articulation, it could be that now that Dolores is in the main, we saw the Elsie rocked to the same explosion. Dolores is in there. She's going to find them and be like, "Put me in there too." And she's going to be a complication to Ford's original plan. Or maybe this is. I mean, I don't know how long a game Ford's playing and what he's actually up to and whether he's a good guy or a bad guy, but at some point, you're right. The stuff where Dolores talking to Bernard / Arnold has to be happening in the simulation, because I do agree with what you were about to go on in the main podcast, which is if they ever violate this aspect ratio thing and use the wide frame in the real world or the narrower frame in the simulation, I might be done with the show. Because that's fuckery of a... Yeah. That's cheating.
It is cheating.
That's throwing dirt in my face if you're a samurai.
It's establishing rules and then not playing by them, which I hate.
Right. And maybe you can take that, like, the Musashi thing as the filmmakers saying that we won't do that because the guy that cheated got killed right away.
Threw dirt in his eyes.
Got dirt thrown in his eyes.
I will say that Ford, as an intelligent person, has to know that this cradle will not remain secure forever, and that he can't simply just stay there.
But he might be kind of like Hodoring it, like he's just trying to. She's trying to.
Yeah, so there are a couple
give
of
them
options.
Enough time.
Yeah, but he's buying time for these hosts to escape before his digital death.
Right.
Where the cradle is blown up,
which would also be an interesting. That would be kind of tie into what Akecheta said to Stubbs. Like that could be some kind of. You know, like his digital death is an actual permanent death. Like, that could be a certain way of looking at that.
Because he's stored in memory right now, essentially.
Exactly.
Computer memory.
Yeah.
Or this could be Ford's plan to knock down another domino in his massive overall plan before he escapes the cradle. Because
there's a lot of people going back to like, well, this is Ford's way of... You know, trying to achieve his own immortality. The other thing I'm not quite sure is, because we're talking about, we don't know how this consciousness transfer works, because it's problematic, like we said, for all the reasons. Like, if you digitally scan your consciousness, put it in another human, put in another host body, how do you know that that's you? Mm-hmm. All right. Beyond the, like, even if you say it's 100% you, is the old you still you and all that stuff? Like, how do you know it's still you? Well, how the hell did they ever transfer Arnold's body or consciousness 30 years ago when this technology is all in its infancy? Mm-hmm. Like, the other problematic thing, something I talked about a while back, is, like, you know, if one of the Delos plots is they're using the simulated technology to, as guests come, to, like, try to predict, to run essentially, like, double-blind fidelity tests. Like, we don't know anything that this person hasn't told us, and we use that information and run simulation after simulation to try to predict her behavior and then compare that with subsequent park visits and just keep pulling that into the model. Like, maybe they made a... If I did that to you, if I just, like, observed you a bunch and tried to feed you into a simulation and I tried to get, like, a gym that would pass the gym sniff test, mm-hmm. is that you? I don't think anyone would say that's you, because there's hidden facets that no one will ever know. Yeah. And, like, at best you have a gym behavioral model that you can use mm-hmm. to predict, but it's still not you. But it might be close enough to you to, like, fool your coworkers or fool... Mm-hmm. Like, if you're a famous person, fool your fans or something like that. And maybe that's good enough. And
yeah, like scratch building a consciousness that resembles
right.
a real person,
right.
I would say is not them.
But it might be good enough for people that don't know them well.
Sure.
And maybe you can even get it to where it'd be good enough to pass people's intimate tests, because people change all the time. Like, something changes and they're different now, you know, mm-hmm. like a death happened or a sickness.
And here's the interesting thing. I don't know that for the purposes of Ford's plan here, he doesn't just need a scratch built Arnold.
Exactly.
Like, he could create an Arnold that so resembles
that
Arnold to Dolores
yeah.
that she can't tell the difference.
Right.
And that therefore her choice to maybe kill him or yeah. or help him or whatever she's gonna yeah. do later on could be a genuine choice.
But here's where I'm getting with this. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that, you know, Delos is doing what Delos wanted to do? They're wanting to use this as a prediction technology, as a marketing technology, as an immortality, as a way to predict what powerful world leaders are going to do. But what if Ford's used it to essentially replace a whole bunch of people already with host bodies, and they're in the world and no one's known, and that's going to be revealed as mm-hmm. a way to kind of, like, force the idea that these robots deserve human rights? Like, if you've replaced 200 of the most famous actors in Hollywood and 10 of the world leaders and 100 surgeons and bankers and, like, and they're already mm-hmm. among, and you're not going to, you won't tell who it is. You'll just say, that's what I've done.
Yeah.
Like, what does that do to the conversation?
I don't know.
The other thing that we have to talk about that's related to this is, so we're talking about the Man in Black's daughter, and I felt confident saying this because we're just essentially talking about observations that a reasonable person can make. Mm-hmm. But if you turn that microscope and turn it around and point at the Man in Black, maybe he just failed a fidelity test.
Yeah.
And then this is starting to sound really like Ford saying this ends where you began and begins where you end.
Yes.
Like the Man in Black is going to realize that at some point he's been swapped out with a host mm-hmm. and
which this was a popular theory that was talked about after right. the James Delos episode.
Right. But I feel like it's something that people have moved off from, and that's I was like, it'd be clever for them to resurrect it.
Yeah, there hasn't until now, I think, been any new supporting evidence.
But that'd be cool, because remember, William, kind of his heart grew dark when he realized Dolores was just a puppet or she was a trick. Mm-hmm. What would that do to him if he realized what do you call a trick that's so good it fools you, like, about you?
I think at the very
reality.
Least, it would give him a new perspective on Dolores.
Yeah.
Right? To maybe see her as, you know, Maeve sees them, as
right.
Maeve sees the hosts. Even the hosts who are not, as we would view them, as woke as Maeve,
right.
are still people. They still right. have those lives they're living. So,
and that would explain. So, like, the theory goes that is the Man in Black. The most popular one that I saw is the Man in Black essentially died the night of the gala, mm-hmm. and was replaced by a copy underneath all those corpses because he didn't have the arm sling. He wasn't otherwise injured. And also, there's a lot of the real Man in Black knew a lot about Native American cultures because mm-hmm. He paid attention to it.
And yet he doesn't see that these are fake Ghost Nation arrows. He gets ambushed several times this episode and taken by surprise, which is not a typical William thing to do. Like, I think that there's something to that. I'd be surprised if one of the many crazy ass reveals we're going to get towards the end of the season isn't the Man in Black is actually a host.
Yeah.
I
can get behind that.
So
I also wanted to talk about one other thing as it relates to people or consciousnesses being put into the bodies of hosts, these hybrids being created. They conspicuously, in my mind, mention that the climate control systems are working.
Right.
Elsie does.
Yeah.
Which to me evokes the image of cold storage. Like, what happens to hosts when the climate goes out? Well, they start to deteriorate and disintegrate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that. So we know that Ford is in charge of the facility.
Mm-hmm.
And he must be the one who has kept climate control on. And now he doesn't need it. He's a fucking ghost in the machine, you know? So what would he be using that for? Maybe preserving some hosts that he's got stashed away. My guess.
I've got an alternate theory.
Perhaps bringing himself back in a hybrid body of himself, you know? Let's bring Sir Anthony Hopkins back.
I don't think cold storage is really that cold because they talked about it not working and everything was, like, unfrozen and the host didn't seem like worse for wear. And also,
no, I thought they did.
Also, we know that we've seen, like, the Ghost Nation warriors laid out in the sun for days, if not weeks, and they can pull their brains and they seem to be fully functional. And their bodies aren't seeming to rot either. I thought that when I heard that, I thought it was Elsie. She's exasperated, like, oh, you got the environment controls. Great job. Like, way to work on the important stuff. But then she later finds out that, like, she's locked out of almost everything. So, like,
that was the only thing they could control. So
yeah,
they did it.
And I thought that's like kind of like a clever thing. Like, Elsie's like, way to go, slackers. But then she realizes, like, oh god, she only has, and like even the team that comes in with dumbfuck McGee, Coughlin, it's like they can barely get the map working. So yeah. Like, for there are some things in the margins that you can fuck with. Like, maybe you can order room service now. But you're right. You are also right that maybe this has something to do with the cold storage stuff too.
It did seem very conspicuous, but
Just want to shout out Luke L because he's the one that sent in the email with the 21-9 widescreen speculation that we kind of trampled all over. So do you have any? Other
I mean,
things?
It was impossible to miss.
That's why I kind of wanted very felt strongly that we should like not talk about it a lot, because I honestly didn't notice it even this episode. When someone pointed out, it's easy to notice, but I did
that's
not
what
notice
I mean.
The
like,
aspect
during my
ratio
research,
changing.
During my research, it was impossible to miss, and I think it's an important language of the show. I don't even think you're meant to speculate on what it means. I think you're meant to be grounded by it. And if you miss it, it's something that...
Well, that's what I said. I didn't mind pointing it out.
That they
like,
wanted you to notice.
Yeah, and but I think...
It's like missing the Man in Black... question whether his daughter was real. Like, they wanted you to notice
sure.
that.
And like I said, pointing out's one thing. But, you know, and I honestly, I don't know how to do this. I'm trying to do it as defensive as possible because I do think that there are a hell of a lot... I'm starting to suspect there's a lot of people going through this haunted house having a lot more fun than we are.
I don't know... I don't know how many people are watching this show...
2.5 million.
In a way that... they watch other shows. Like, I think most of the people, the vast majority of people who are watching this show are looking for the nitty-gritty details and the puzzle element of it. I really do.
It's tough to say.
Because I think if you're watching this show casually, you get lost and you turn it off. I think this is not a Game of Thrones size hit, not because of the quality of it, but because of the complexity of it.
You might be right.
Because Game of Thrones is far more watchable. Far more.
I think it's more surface level and entertaining, sure.
Yes.
And maybe you could argue if you stripped away the puzzle box shit, this would be like a 5-hour season that's just more straightforward and entertaining and enjoyable. But I don't know, because I've also heard multiple reports of people saying that when you binge this stuff or you watch it after the fact and you're not waiting between, you know, weeks in between seeing stuff and speculating, that it is highly, it's a very bingeable, enjoyable show.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely more of a thinker. I'm not going to ever say it's as accessible as like Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones, but
I think to stick with it, you have to be willing to engage your brain on that level. And if you're not, you don't stick with it. You just turn it off. So I feel like
it seems like there are a lot of people doing that, but And I do think, I honestly wish I could just fucking smoke a bowl of herb and have a nice scotch and watch this show and then be like, huh, well, can't wait to see what they do next week. Like, if I was not running Bald Move with you, that's exactly how I'd be watching it. And I think it would be more fun. That's not to say I wouldn't think about it and toss it over my head, but like, I don't think this thing is. I don't think this thing is meant to be put into a tank full of a million people obsessed with it, sifting through every piece, manipulating pixels and all that. A person doing that, and but like,
I think
we're
that's
not talking
precisely
about it. We're talking about the
hot.
We're talking about the hive mind doing it.
No, I think that's precisely what it's built for.
If it's if it can survive that scrutiny, I think it will be amazing. Yeah, that's why we thought so highly of the first season, because it kind of did hold up after all that. Maggie wants to know, what happened to these violent delights have violent ends being a verbal cue that triggers a robot to becoming sentient? Why doesn't Maeve say it to Akane instead of trying the weird whispers in her mind? I was expecting it to hear it when Maeve approached Akane, unless, of course, Ford set up only some robots to be triggered by the phrase and not all. I leave deep thinking to you. I don't have much deep thoughts. I think the violent delights have violent ends was, if I'm being super honest, a leftover part of the pilot season of the Westworld that we never got, where that kissy actor didn't die, and the Native American mythology had a much bigger part of it, and Abernathy Shakespeare, like I think those things were all changed when the actor that played Kissy died, and they streamlined a lot of that Native American influence and went in a completely different direction with it. I think that's a real answer. Mm-hmm. But they did bring it. What's curious is they brought it back this year with Raj World. So I don't know what to make of that. I really don't know what they're trying to do. I don't think it literally is a verbal virus the way I did in early goings of season one.
Right.
It might be, like, who knows, that Indian guide might have been part of a Shakespearean production. Like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense why Maeve, or why Dolores whispers it to Maeve, and why Maeve started, like, I don't know. I have not enough information, and it does feel like a cop out to say it's a production mistake, because if that was the case, why double down in season two?
That's a good question.
That could be.
I really don't know the answer.
If I put on my real hard thinking cap on, I could say that's a suggestion that there are multiple things going on at the same time, and this is a classic Michael Crichton situation where you have multiple complex systems that people are fucking with for their own reasons. Like, Dennis Nedry stealing the embryos had nothing to do with the, you know, the dinosaurs evolving the ability to mate. And it had nothing to do with, like, the hurricane that hit. But it's all these complicated systems interacting in weird, unpredictable ways. Mm-hmm. And you get chaos as a result. And I think that maybe maybe that is a verbal virus that's going around for some other reason, that's interacting with the reveries, it's interacting with the Ford code, and there's something else that we don't understand that's involved with Ghost Nation, of course. I don't know. Rob G, are the flies supposed to be represent, perhaps too literally, bugs in the code, at least from the Daedalus perspective? In season one, Dolores first becomes conscious. When she first becomes conscious, there's a scene where she dramatically slaps and kills a fly on her face. From the point of view of Ford, the reveries are features, but from the Daedalus point of view, they are bugs. Is this too on the nose? They nailed a Christ figure to a platform episode, so no, it's not too on the nose. And I do also think that there's something to it, because there is that really loud buzzing noise going on about Teddy when he makes the hasty decision to kill that dude.
Mm-hmm.
He also wonders if robot sex can produce baby robots. This is something we've talked about.
Yep.
We just don't know. We think the hosts are fully biological beings, but I think it would be madness to create a robot that can have sex with another robot and make another robot.
Yeah. What are you trying to accomplish with that?
Yeah. And will that baby robot have an empty brain because it's designed to have a marble plugged into it? Is that going to be part of the robot birthing process?
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? But then again, I also think it's stupid to program a robot to only understand a constructed language at a higher level of its operating system when you need core-level access to it. And apparently that's the way they're designed. Aaron wouldn't make it as a programmer at this place. Rishi V. It seems to me that Dolores houses two separate personalities and backstories, Wyatt and classic Dolores. Fair enough. This seems like an integration of essentially two separate consciousness. We've seen some of this on display at the fort where she let the soldiers get slaughtered, but also had a tender moment with her father. Well, if there can essentially be two consciousness in one host, why not three? Could Bernard house Bernard and Dolores and Wyatt? Yeah. Or do you reject the idea that Dolores really houses two separate consciousness melded in one?
No, just bring them all in. Let's just put the cradle into one person's head.
Yeah, legion it up.
Maybe that's Bernard waking up on the beach. He's every single one of them.
And Peter Abernathy's going to wake up and cast them all out into a herd of swine, fulfilling his role as Christ on the show.
As the Judas steer, he's going to lead them right off the cliff.
I mean, let's unpack this. I don't think Dolores and Wyatt are two consciousness melded together.
Like, I agree.
That's very like Star Trek symbiote stuff. I think is they are merged in the sense that you'd merge two code bases.
I think she has access to the memories of both of those characters that she has been in the past.
Right.
And that she, now being her own damn self, is essentially struggling between which of her past selves she wants to be in the future. I don't think it's literally like two consciousnesses fighting it out in her marble brain.
Right, right, yeah. No, I don't think there's like, and it's not like the Wyatt personality is fighting and now he's dominant and then the Dolores fights and now she's dominant. I think they're just completely merged and blended, and essentially now would be a unique new consciousness.
Right.
That's neither Dolores nor Wyatt.
Yeah.
I don't have any evidence for that. That's just what I'm, my interpretation of the evidence thus far. Rich S., isn't the fact that Ford created Bernard showing that Ford was able to transfer consciousness? William failed with Delos, but Ford didn't. Bernard seems to have been working fine for years. I mean, that goes back to, we don't know how this consciousness transfer works. Is it plausible that you could transfer a consciousness at a high fidelity 30 years before the technology is close to being perfected by your next nearest competitor? I don't know. Like, that's where it's like... And how is the simulation tied into this? To me, the simulation is key. If you can just transfer someone's fucking consciousness, then you wouldn't need to do the simulation. The simulation wouldn't be a big part of this episode or this season. I think the simulation, that they're not actually transferring consciousness. They're just gathering a bunch of input and then running a simulation until it's indistinguishable from the real thing. Which is some half-assed discount immortality, if you ask me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not even trying to grapple with anything philosophically.
No, I think, to me, it's always been a case of Bernard is a different animal. He was built from scratch by Ford, the same way that Ford's family was built from scratch. He obviously doesn't have brain patterns of himself as a young child, right? He invented this tech, so... Not possible. And yet he created himself as a young man. So I think there are three different types of hosts going on here. There's the typical host with their typical loops meant to service the patrons of the park.
So that's like Clementine 2.0.
Right. And old Dolores and Teddy and all them. Then there's Bernard, who is kind of a scratch build personality in a standard host body. Mm-hmm. And then there's like the hybrid hosts, who are human personalities which at some point had been interviewed and scanned and are trying to get as close to possible as the actual person. Mm-hmm. And they are put into host bodies. That's the best I can delineate these different types of creatures here.
Ashley F. I wanted to say, first of all, Coughlin would like to shit on your name. Just wanted to let you know.
My name?
Ashley.
Oh, okay.
He gives your name an F, Ashley. fuck that guy. I just want to suggest something. In the opening scene, I viewed it as clearly suggesting Dolores is testing Bernard. I think it's the reverse. I think that Dolores is the one being tested. I think the blue dress is key. It means a lot for the first season. Dolores did not wear that blue dress anymore for this timeline or season. If Delos was attempting to run her through a loop like it seems like they're doing for Bernard, they would dress her the same and return her to the timeline she's supposed to be on. It doesn't make sense for Dolores to choose to wear that dress given she's rejected so much from that narrative.
But wait. Here's what's happening in this scene.
Uh-huh.
She's interviewing Bernard in a manner that Bernard has interviewed her before.
Arnold,
Arnold, yes, has interviewed her before. And in those those memories, she was wearing that dress, and that is why
that's part of the fidelity.
Whoever you think Dolores is in this scene, yes, that's part of the fidelity.
Got to keep your end of the fidelity up for the other end to work out too,
right? So that's why she's in that dress.
Yeah.
And we don't know when this is happening either, most importantly.
Right. Because, yeah, I mean, think about, like, if William came in and he's like, hey, for this round, I'm going to cover my head and catch up and come in. And yeah. Like, God, Jim, someone shot me in the head. Like, he's not going to start up with the, like, it took you long enough. He's going to be right. Like, my God, William, who shot you? Like,
yeah.
You fucked up the fidelity, old man. Like, yeah, to me, she wouldn't just wear the blue dress cause. She's playing a part, right?
Yeah. And have we talked about, like, the theories on
now,
who this is in this scene?
Now, I do think that there is something, like, now that we know this is taking place in a simulation, mm-hmm. like, it would be interesting if somehow there is a layer above the layer that Ford is actually using Dolores, thinking she's running a fidelity test on Bernard Arnold to actually run a fidelity test on her.
Oh, okay.
Because, gotcha. I mean... Because, yeah, what if Ford has tampered with her programming in an effort to make her free, but he is trying to satisfy his own curiosity that she is her own person? So he's running her through these fidelity tests. Like, I'm not trying to shit on your theory, Ashley, because I think there's something to there. I just don't think, like, the blue dress maybe is the ultimate. But without the blue dress, there's really nothing, but wouldn't it be cool, which... Mm-hmm. Isn't a great, as we've talked about, isn't a great...
Are you talking about the theories that Ford is actually Dolores in this scene?
I didn't
Bernard through the fidelity test himself.
Oh, let me ask you this. There's a theory I read just before we sat down that, because we're talking about how the captions were all over the place last night.
Yeah, they were.
They said Sun Up was Stump, which they fixed this morning. Gala was Gauntlet, which is still, as of 3 hours ago, as of 10 a.m. on Wednesday morning, still fucked up. And also, they consistently credited Elsie as Hale.
Yeah.
There is some speculation that Bernard is misremembering all this as, or this is a simulation, or now I don't think it's a simulation because they don't use the aspect ratios, but there's probably is the closed captioning giving away some sort of fuckery here? Because Bernard's clearly an unreliable narrator.
He is, 100%. And they're doing a lot of stuff with his memory. Like, a lot of the weirdness we see around that is, I don't think it's simulation stuff. I think it's memory stuff.
Right.
And potentially, like, new brain adjusting to new host body kind of stuff. But my gut says no, that this is just a slip. Like, they named this character Hale in some file somewhere. And the system read it and was like, oh, all of these characters' lines are Hale.
Or the caption, like, because her last name actually is Hughes instead of Hale, and that's kind of close, I guess, if you're doing some kind of machine interpretation thing. Although, recall that there's a lot of discussion about when we found Elsie, she had flawless costume and makeup, even though she'd been chained in a cave for multiple days with just protein bars in a bucket.
Right.
Like... that could be suggestive of yet. I mean, we know Bernard is being fucked with continually throughout all these scenes. Mm-hmm. We don't know if Elsie is part of that fuckery.
Yeah.
It does all. I don't know, man. It's just sometimes when Elsie is like an unguarded moment, like when she's sitting waiting for Bernard and inside the cradle, but Bernard's inside the cradle, if you know what I mean, where there's no reason for her to act like anything but Elsie, and she reads as Elsie.
Yeah.
Like if that's Catherine Hale giving an Elsie performance when no one's there to see it, like, what the fuck?
Why? Yeah.
It's because this show's made anything fucking possible. So, John R., he wanted us to look into, like, last season we talked about the man in the maze, right? This Native American myth. Have you heard of the one about the white buffalo?
No.
We sent in an article talking about the legend and importance of the white buffalo, and I found it fascinating. There's no fucking way this shit doesn't pay off, just like the man in a maze did last year. To Native Americans, the bison or American buffalo is a symbol of sacred life and abundance. The importance and this symbolism were created from a legend. One summer, a long time ago, the seven sacred council fires of the Lakota Sioux came together and camped. The sun was strong, the people were starving, for there was no game. Two young men went out to hunt in the Black Hills of South Dakota. Along the way, a beautiful young woman dressed in white appeared to the warriors and said, "Return to your people and tell them I am coming." This holy woman presented the Lakota people with a sacred pipe which showed how all things were connected.
That's a weed pipe.
I've smoked that pipe. I saw how things were connected for sure.
Yeah.
She taught the Lakota people the mysteries of the earth. She taught them to pray and follow the proper path while on earth. As a woman left the tribe, she rolled upon the earth four times, changing color each time, finally turning into a white buffalo calf. She then disappeared. At almost the same time as her leaving, great herds of buffalo could be seen surrounding the camps. It said that after that day, the Lakota honored their pipe and buffalo were plentiful. This story of the white buffalo woman has immense importance to Lakota and many other tribes. As James Lame Deer, a spiritual healer, says, a white buffalo is the most sacred living thing you could ever encounter. The changing colors, like some white buffalo do as they age, have significance too, which must be interpreted by a holy man. The American buffalo, or bison, is a symbol of abundance and manifestation. The lesson learned by the Lakota is one does not have to struggle to survive. This is especially true if the right action is joined by the right prayer. By learning to appropriately unite the mundane with the divine, all that will be needed will be provided. The Native Americans see the birth of a white buffalo calf as the most significant prophetic signs, equivalent to the weeping statues, bleeding icons, and crosses of light that are prevalent within Christian churches today. Let's see. The arrival of the white buffalo is like the second coming of Christ, says Floyd Hand Looks for Buffalo, an Oglala medicine man from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. It will bring about purity of mind, body, and spirit and unify all nations, black, red, yellow, and white. He sees the birth of the white calf as an omen because they happen in the most unexpected places and often amongst the poorest people in the nation. The birth of the sacred white buffalo provides those within Native American communities with a sense of hope and indication that good times are to come. Now, I want to talk about this in context of the intro to Westworld, which we see a white buffalo being formed and then rampaging through the facility.
Hmm.
And how the white buffalo is essentially a Christ figure to these people. And we know the Lakota is the language that the Ghost Nation is speaking. And I thought there's some interesting things, like, who would be the white woman that we're looking for? We see Maeve in her flashbacks to being a mother is dressed all in white. Dolores is wearing white.
Yeah, it seems like Maeve is perhaps represented in that intro as well with the child.
Right. And that, like, so this is, it's also this is an explicit rejection of, like, zero-sum game capitalism, right? The fact that, like, if you just say the right prayers and believe in harmony, that the universe will provide you with everything they need versus you have to go out and take what's yours and keep and protect it from others. They'll steal you,
mm-hmm.
which kind of broadly seems like, I mean, Maeve hasn't got there yet, but we're not through the season. But Dolores is clearly, this is, there's only so much freedom and security, and we have to make sure we get it and the humans don't, whereas Maeve might be trying to find this middle path. She's the white buffalo.
Sure, I can absolutely see her story going that direction.
There's also that in the preseason trailer where we see Maeve kind of like directing a herd of buffalo to the facility. I thought that was shot just for the trailer as like some kind of thematic shit, but the more I see Maeve interfacing with the mesh technology, the more I believe she can just literally command a herd of buffalo to go rampaging through this facility.
Yeah.
And her taking on the manifestation of the white buffalo to somehow, but to what end? Is she the one that destroys the cradle? Why is the cradle destroyed?
Very good question.
Still a lot of mystery intact this late into season.
Yeah, we have four more episodes.
Yeah, we're just over the hump. But I thought, like, just in the same way, because if you think back to the man in the maze theory, that predicted a lot of things, chief among them, the using the host and bulk storage, the people underground, to form an army for oneself to do this great rebellion. So I thought that we considered the long-form version of this myth just to see how all this stuff can happen. Now, the other thing is, you'd have to look, so you got to look for who the woman in white is. You also have to look to see what form this pipe will take that allows people to see the connections between themselves and the universe. Like, how do you do that with robots? Is that merging into the cradle? Mm. Is that going to be like
the mesh network?
Yeah, or is that going to be the fact that, you know, like there's some humans that are hosts that show that they're, I don't know. But like I said,
those Native American legends had a lot to do with how things wrapped up last season. I want to put this out there through the conduit of John R. to see what we can make of it. And I believe, yes, this is the last of the theory stuff that we're going to consider. So anything else you want to say?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. We wrapped it up in just over 2 hours. Westworld, turn an hour show into a tight two hours.
Yeah.
Westworld at baldmove.com if you'd like to send us feedback. Of course, we also have the forums, forums.baldmove.com. If you'd like to follow all the things that we're doing, you got to go to baldmove.com, or you can go to social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, @baldmove. We will see you again Sunday. Don't forget, right after the episode, we have the instant talk podcast where Jim and I kind of like break down the episode for a couple minutes, then we flip it to our audience. You have to be a club to participate in it. This is your final opportunity to save 25% off annual subscription to the club. So two more days, like
don't sleep.
June 1st, it's gone. It goes away. It's like tears in the rain. So check it out, club.baldmove.com, if you want to get into the full instant talk podcast. We will see you then if we don't see you before. And until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Later.